This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Someone who, I think like many of you, has been interested in public affairs for a long time. Probably somebody like many of you who's followed politics for a long time. So, especially in the era before there was 24-hour cable news, I would just devour any sort of news that I could get about political campaigns. Because the 22 minutes on the nightly news was just not enough for me. And I would perpetually be disappointed at the kind of things that we would see in political coverage, not only in New York, but around the country and honestly around the world. And I'd notice, and then when I went to college and studied this stuff a little bit, this was documented not just in terms of my anecdotal impression, it was documented as statistically true, that, and it remains true, perhaps more than ever, that almost all of political coverage is dominated by three things. Gaffes, and I'll say gaffes slash scandals. Fundraising numbers, oh, this person's raised this much, this person's raised that much. And yes, polls. Now, I have been so frustrated at looking at all of the political coverage over the last 20, 30 years, but especially over the last 10 years, and seeing so much of it dominated by what the polls say, because the media then use these polls as indicators of who's a serious candidate and who's not. And it gets worse. In the presidential race, they don't even let you participate in the presidential debates unless you're at a certain number at the polls. Now, it's a joke. And I've always said, since I've been on the radio over the last 10 or 11 years, I've always said we should not take the polls into account, not spend a lot of time talking about them on the air. And now this week, you have this story where once again, the pollsters got it wrong. You have this big report come out from the leading association of pollsters confirming just how wrong the 2020 election polls were. Now, 9 months after that election, the people asking why are still looking for the answers. So the national surveys, the national polls of the 2020 presidential race were the least accurate in 40 years. 40 years! And the state polls weren't much better. They were the least accurate in two decades. That's according to this new comprehensive report from the American Association for Public Opinion Research. But unlike in 2016, when pollsters could explain why they got it wrong, they underestimated Donald Trump, the educational divide, and they come up with recommendations to fix future polling models. Now, these pollsters are scratching their head. They have no idea what's going on. They have no idea why they got it wrong. So here's my vote. Can we do this? Can we take the conventional playbook of political journalism and just tear it up? Who needs this? Who needs to see and hear on television and radio, respectively, and read in the papers, oh, the so-and-so is leading the race for mayor. He's number one in the polls. How about you don't tell us who's number one in the polls? The polls have proven time and again to be inaccurate. Just tell us what the candidates are doing. Just tell us what the candidates' ideas are. Don't report on the fundraising numbers. Don't report on the polls. Tell us what the candidates are actually proposing and let us make decisions for ourselves. How about that? Can we have a gentleman's agreement among people that cover media and politics that that's how we're going to do things? Because it's not just 2020. It's not just 2016. If it were just those two things, you could explain this phenomena away with just one factor, Donald Trump. People are afraid to say they're for Trump and don't want to tell a pollster. But it goes far beyond this. We saw this with Brexit. The polls underestimated the support for the Brexit vote in the UK. And we've seen it as well in local races. You saw it when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez beat Joe Crowley. Nobody saw that coming. And the polls didn't reflect it. You saw it when Dan Donovan beat Michael Grimm for Congress, because Grimm was polling neck and neck. Actually, I think Grimm was leading, according to the polls. The polls are baloney. The polls are nonsense. And I don't think, in my humble opinion, that polling models reflect how people communicate these days. So many of the polling models, even the ones that say they don't, so many of these polling models rely on landlines. So many of these, and we're just in a new era. I feel like people don't feel like sharing every single thought that they have about who they want to vote for. You're seeing, in part because we're under constant surveillance and because everything we do is tracked and recorded and monitored, you're seeing a little bit of a backlash in which some people still want to value privacy. And I think that's some of the reason you're seeing inaccurate polls. I think it goes beyond Trump. I'd love to hear your thoughts on two things. One, why? Why did the polls get it wrong? Again, worst polling errors in 40 years. 800-848-WABC. It's 1-800-848-9222. Do you think that this will be the case in elections where Donald Trump is not on the ballot? Because in 2018, in fairness, most of the polls, with the exception of the two congressional races that I just mentioned, most of the polls nationally got it right on the midterms. So in the 2022 midterms, for instance, in the 2021 mayor's race, are the polls going to be wrong again? I suspect they are. And you know how, and I am just waiting for the first poll in the New York City mayor's race. You remember how in 2013, when Joe LaHuda became the Republican nominee, Joe LaHuda, now a Democrat, by the way, I hope all you Republicans that supported him in 2013 over John Catsimatidis are happy. But remember when de Blasio won the Democrat primary, LaHuda won the Republican primary, and they rushed a poll out within the next week showing that de Blasio was beating LaHuda and that LaHuda was polling at over 30%. That basically had the effect of deflating whatever energy existed in LaHuda, and I know it's LaHuda, but I like to say LaHuda, because what's that H doing there anyway? That had the effect of deflating whatever energy was in LaHuda's campaign in 2013. He couldn't raise money. Oh, who would give money to someone that's polling at 30%? I believe, you call me conspiratorial, maybe, but what's nighttime radio if we can't be a little conspiratorial? I believe that part of the reason you have not seen any media organization come out with a poll in the mayor's race is I do think the polls show Curtis Sliwa at a much higher degree of support than the punditocracy is ready to give him credit for. Now, I don't think we should read too much into that. Because some people said to me, oh, maybe the campaign should do a poll. And the campaign could do a poll showing Curtis nipping at Eric Adams' heels and release it. I think that would be a waste of money. I remember talking to some pollsters because I was a big part of Curtis's advisory team during the primary. I'm not so much a big part these days in the general. He's got a more seasoned team around him and other people. And I'm pretty busy being on the radio 5.5 hours a day. But I talked to some pollsters during the primary about commissioning a poll for Curtis. And the numbers that these guys quoted me were astronomical. Astronomical. Tens of thousands of dollars. What? Excuse me? Tens of thousands of dollars to tell me what? What I already know, that we're going to win this primary in a landslide and that we're an underdog in the general election? No, thank you. We'll keep our tens of thousands of dollars and spend it on radio commercials or anything else or digital ads or you name it. But I would love to hear from you at 800-848-9222 on the one, why do you think the polls were wrong? And two, will you join my call to stop paying attention to the polls? From now on, unless, again, I'm ready to make some exceptions to this, but when I see a journalist or a commentator start spouting on and on about polls, I'm out of there. I'm changing the channel. I am no longer paying attention to the polls. And this is going to be a tough vow to keep during the WABC early news because, after all, we have 90 minutes of news to fill. I am no longer going to be reporting on any stories that have anything to do with polls. If a story comes out that shows Eric Adams at 70%, Curtis Lee with 30%, I'm not reporting it. If a story comes out showing Lee Zeldin at 40%, Andrew Cuomo at 60%, I'm not reporting it. Story comes out showing Andrew Cuomo at 70% and Jumaane Williams at 30%, I'm not reporting it. I no longer believe these polls, and I don't think you should either. But ultimately, we all have the ability to make our own decisions about what we want to pay attention to. I will tell you that I think if you are looking to get rich quick, the best thing you could be these days is a pollster. Go out, start your own polling firm. Clearly, the rest of these guys aren't too accurate because 2020, I heard 9,000 people say this was going to be the most important election in our lifetime, and the pollsters stepped up to the plate, and ultimately they totally swung and whiffed. 800-848-WABC. Got a great show for you. Anthony DeStefano is going to be joining me at 1:30. We're going to do a follow-up on our series going into the Gilgo Beach murders. And I'm going to talk to him a little bit about his new book, all about Vito Genovese. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and a terrific journalist, one of my favorite people to talk to. That's coming up at 1:30. And then at 3:30, Simon Constable will be here. He's one of the best financial journalists in the world, and I'm looking forward to getting his take on what's happening with the economy. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me begin with Larry in Brooklyn. Hello, Larry.
Hey, Frank, how you doing? You know what? I agree with you, and I'll tell you for 2 points. First of all, in the 2020 poll, I already heard stories on it. It was proven that the reason the polls were so off is because people were not willing. Trump was so disparaged by the media that people were not willing not only to admit that they were voting for Trump, but to even participate in the poll. And yet, they polled anyway. So what does that tell you? It tells you that if a pollster cannot produce a poll, forget about an accurate poll, but even a representative sample, he'll do it anyway, and he'll go with the results because he wants to stay in business, okay? So that shows you right away that they're dishonest. But larger than that, if they're wrong once, who the hell needs it? It's a service. It's a luxury. So why do I need a luxury that's wrong? It's not the weather forecast that I'm depending on every day to know what to wear. This is a luxury I can do without.
Exactly. But also, as a voter, what does knowing the polls really do for you, right? So if you know one candidate is more likely to win than another, should that's what I find so disturbing about these polls, because the media, they love to report on these polls, and all it does is have the effect of suppressing the vote of a candidate that might not be doing well in the polls.
Exactly. I have no idea. I took a course in polling and political science back in college, and back then I didn't understand the purpose of the whole course. So today I still don't understand it.
Well said, Larry. Thank you. Look, I'm all for covering politics. I'm all for getting candidates' ideas out there, covering their proposals, covering candidates' personal biographical information, covering their own history, or even if there's a scandal. But if a candidate says there's 54 states instead of 50, I mean, how much time do we need to spend on that? If a candidate calls somebody Tim Apple instead of whatever his last name is, Tim Cook, then how much time do we really need to spend on that? I really think we need to, for our own country's sake, change the whole nature of political journalism in this country. It's got to be about more than gaffes, fundraising, and polls. Because clearly, I think we've seen the polls are wrong far too often. 1-800-848-WABC. Susan is in Brooklyn. Hello, Susan.
Hi there. Listen, yeah, you're absolutely right. The polls don't matter. The constituencies. And Curtis has the palm of his hand. The biggest constituency in New York City are parents, our grandparents, our aunts, uncles, everybody, even if you don't have children, is the poisoning of the next generation and how the mayor has control of the education system. He barely speaks about education. He talks about cats and dogs, which we all love too. But let's put the kids as the priority because that is connected to crime. Undereducation is feeding the crime situation. He has to dually talk about crime and the corrupt education, the curriculum that is poisoning our children and not
educating
them.
Susan, I don't disagree with you.
$30 billion on education.
I don't disagree with you, Susan. And I know Curtis listens to this program just about every morning. And chances are he just heard your advice right now as well. 800-848-WABC. But on the off chance he's not, I will be happy to reiterate that to him. 800-848-9222. Tony DiStefano coming up in about 9 minutes. Very much looking forward to discussing Vito Genovese.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Talking with Tony DiStefano in 5 minutes, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist. He's got a new book out about Vito Genovese. I'm also going to ask him about his work into these Gilgo Beach killings, find out if we're any closer to getting the Long Island serial killer or serial killers. This is Wednesday, which means coming up at 3 o'clock, we're going to play Stump the Audience, where we'll give you a chance to win a hat in any category of your choice. So you'll be able to take your stab at whatever category you want, and if you can answer two questions, you'll win a hat. That's coming up at 3 o'clock. Now, I will tell you, this is my second day trying to do this show caffeine-free. Day two. Now, a lot of you asked me how day one of being decaffeinated went. I think it went, from the show's perspective, I think it went really well. I think we had a very good show yesterday. I certainly didn't feel fatigued. I don't think there was any significant depreciation in my energy levels. I don't think my performance here was off in the least, quite frankly. Again, maybe I'm not the best person to judge. The people like Paul Gambino out there, they love to tell me that occasionally I sound tired. I didn't think I sounded tired in the least. However, then I will tell you, when I was driving home, I was pretty drowsy. And I was about two-thirds of the way home. And I was on the last maybe 25 minutes of my trip. And I kept fighting falling asleep. So I said, let me do the responsible thing. Let me pull over. I actually pulled into a parking lot. I pulled into a parking lot and I went to sleep. And I slept. I don't know how long I slept because I'm usually home by about 7:45. And so it must have been maybe 7:15. And then my wife called me around 8:20. So I might have slept almost an hour, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. And she said something to the effect of, you're either having an affair or you're falling asleep somewhere. And she's saying, I'm hoping it's the latter. And certainly it was. So I then went home. And my first day of decaffeinated dreaming, I did feel like the dreams, which I've heard this before, I've read other people, were a little bit more vivid than they normally are when I'm hopped up on caffeine. And a lot of times I'll wake up several times in the middle of the day before going back to sleep. I think I only woke up once, briefly, and then I went right back to sleep. So as far as day one of being caffeine free went, I think it went pretty well. Now, I did have a cup of decaf coffee today, which they say has a little bit of caffeine. But I had this, I was talking to Dominic Carter before the show, and I had this tickle in my throat. And I said, all right, let me go try and get some tea. You know, I'm thinking about some tea, some honey. That'll coat my throat a little bit. And I go in there and I see that we have Earl Grey, that has caffeine. We have black tea, that's got caffeine. And I'm looking for an herbal tea of some sort. The only thing I found was green tea. And this particular brand of green tea did not say caffeine free. So I know some green teas do have some caffeine. So I said, let me not risk it. Let me continue the experiment. And I tried the cup of decaffeinated coffee, which I hate to do. But in my view, at least it smelled good. At least it was hot. And kind of coated my throat a little bit. So far, day two seems to be going just as well. 800-848-WABC. We're going to talk about Vito Genovese with Tony DiStefano in just a minute. But first, we're talking about the failure of pollsters to predict the national polls in the 2020 election, to predict the state polls in the 2020 election. Is this simply a function of Trump? I don't think so. I think the polling models are out of date. I think people are not in the mood to talk to pollsters anymore. I think that polling is yesterday's news. 800-848-9222. What do you think? Joe is in Jamaica. Hello, Joe.
Hey there, Frank. How you doing? Very quickly, there's one thing you're forgetting about a poll. There are other purposes for doing so. Yes, there are some inaccurate polls and everything else, but the person doing the polling could also have a mission in mind. For example, when Trump was running, if they asked, let's say, 100 Democrats, naturally Democrats are going to say, hey, no, we're not voting for Trump. And therefore, the pollster may be trying to influence the election and convince the readers, oh, look, this guy's not doing too well, so therefore you may have to vote for the Democrat, whatever the case may be. So it depends on the purpose of, you know, the pollster.
Well, I mean, that is, and I don't disagree with you that there was some inaccurate and dishonest polling in the 2020 election, especially, and other people have written about that. But the sampling, who they're sampling, is supposed to be reflected in the crosstabs, and it's supposed to be disclosed. Like, they're not supposed to poll 100 Democrats and then pass that off as if it's an objective poll. That, you know, you
exactly.
That's reflected.
Yep.
That's reflected in the polls that are reporting. But I'm saying even polls that had a diverse sample size or a diverse sample group, they were inaccurate too.
Yeah, but don't forget the old expression they used to say. That is, the only poll that's correct is one taken on election day and so forth. And pretty much, you know, like I said, that's the way I see it now. Even when I read current polls, you don't see who they sample to get this information. So I think there's a lot of dishonesty there as well.
Well, it's a fair point, Joe. That was back when we had just one day of voting. Now, with early voting, I guess the only poll that counts is election month, right? 800-848-9222. Let's say hello to the infamous Vincent in Brooklyn. Hello, Vincent.
Good evening, Frankie. How you doing? And I'm just calling to say that Vito Genovese's niece was a very good friend and worked with my mother. My mother's dead a long time ago. And my family was privy to a lot of the dirt, and I'm just listening to see this guy, this guest you're going to have, where did he get his information from?
Well,
and
I don't know if you read the book,
what
Vincent.
What makes the public think that people who were in the life were going to give this guy the correct information?
Did you read the book, Vincent?
I don't have to read the book.
All right, well, I'd be curious.
I lived the life.
I would be curious. Well, I can tell you have, Vincent, but I would be curious.
I've lived the life, Frank.
Vincent, I hear you. If you read the book, I would be curious if you felt
Frank,
there were particular.
The definitive book on the mob is by William Balsamo. It's called Under the Clock. William Balsamo, the guy who wrote the book, his ancestor was one of the first godfathers of New York in the 19th century. He was a very good friend of mine.
Well, all I'm saying, and I will check out your book. If you read the book, I think you'd be pretty impressed. And if you're not, I'd be curious if you what specific things you felt were inaccurate. But
what
listen,
specific thing, Frank? I've lived this on a daily basis.
Vincent, I hear you. I hear you.
These people lived in my neighborhood.
Vincent, I'm not disagreeing with you. If I read a book about WABC radio, I'd want to read it just so I could tell people what was inaccurate about it.
Exactly.
Thank you for the call.
Well, I'm waiting to hear what he has to say.
All right. Well, we will look forward to your review, both of the interview and the book. See, Vincent's a caller. You got to be careful before you hang up on him. Am I right? All right. You could tell. You could tell. 800-848-9222. Appreciate the Mark Simone Show lending us the services of Vincent in Brooklyn. He was exclusive to the Mark Simone Show for years, but we've done some behind-the-scenes negotiating that allow Vincent one phone call a day from a secure and undisclosed location to this program. So thank you. 800-848-9222. We'll talk about the Gilgo Beach murders and about Vito Genovese with Anthony DiStefano next. Of midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. It is always a treat to be able to talk with one of my favorite journalists, Anthony DiStefano, a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalist and a best-selling author whose latest book is The Deadly Don, Vito Genovese, Mafia Boss. Tony, it is great to talk with you. Thanks for staying up late for us.
Frank, I'm happy to talk to you. I'm also glad to see that you're such a responsible driver, pulling over when you're drowsy.
That's right. That's right. Frank Moreno, civic pillar of civic virtue. That's what I'm changing my business card to. I want to talk to you about your book, and very much enjoyed reading it, but that's not quite a surprise because I've enjoyed all of your books. I believe I've read all of them. I want to first, though, ask you about a story we've been covering on the radio that you've been covering at length. That's the story of the Gilgo Beach murders. You've done a lot of reporting based on the forensics into the victims of the Long Island serial killer. What can you tell folks about what the forensics suggest about these killings?
Well, the forensics that I was keyed to in doing some of the reporting had to do with attempts to identify the four unidentified victims. As you know, there were 10 victims. And four remains were unidentified. The other six were, more or less quickly identified through regular DNA channels and other forensics. But the forensics are telling us that they're not putting us yet into a definite suspect as far as we know. But what the forensics are now evolving to do is to identify these four other victims. And one was a girl from, well, a woman from New Jersey who was identified last year. And that was Valerie Mack, who had lived in Jersey and also Philadelphia. And she was found dismembered as part of the Gilgo grouping. And that was done through genetic genealogy, which is an interesting technique that they developed. And for Suffolk County was able to use it because they teamed up with the FBI. And the FBI is not under any constraints of state law. The state labs, crime labs, can't necessarily use genetic genealogy. They can now, but that's changed. But back in 2020, they couldn't. So they went to the FBI, and the FBI is under no constraints. And they were able to take the sample, the genetic sample of this victim, and run it through the genealogical searching. And that's, let me tell you, I don't know how they do this, but there are genealogists who take the DNA, upload it to a genetic website, these public websites like 23andMe and those, and they come across relatives, distant relatives of these victims, and they're able to backtrack, as it were, create a family tree, and get to a point where at some point they come to a relative who gives them a clue as to who this person might be. And then they get closer and closer, they narrow the circle, and they get a DNA sample from a living person who will help identify the crime victim. And that's been going on for the last year and a half, and they're trying to do it with the other three victims. They're having a little bit of trouble because the DNA samples are somewhat more degraded. So they're going to have to try some new techniques to zero in on what's left of the DNA and try to get some sort of match. But it's fascinating stuff, I got to tell you.
Oh, no, that's for sure. Now, does the forensics work, including these genealogy analyses, does that suggest anything about, and I imagine it doesn't, but does that suggest anything about whether this is the work of one killer or multiple killers?
No, that doesn't. I mean, what they're doing now, they're focusing on the victims, so it's not going to tell you much about who the killer or killers may be. People have different theories about it. Some think it may be one person, some people.
Talking with Tony DiStefano. He's been a great reporter for Newsday for a long time. These days, he's the author of a book called The Deadly Don, Vito Genovese, Mafia Boss. We'll be talking about that book and a little bit about some of the other cases he's been covering in the pages of Newsday. We lost Tony there. We're going to try and get him back.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Talking with Tony DiStefano. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author whose latest book is The Deadly Don, Vito Genovese, Mafia Boss. All right, Tony, Vito Genovese, for the uninitiated, who was he? A lot of folks can probably surmise that he's the namesake of the Genovese crime family, one of the most infamous, one of the most storied mafia families in this country, based in New York. But if you were, in a nutshell, who was Vito Genovese?
Vito Genovese was an Italian immigrant in the early 20th century who clawed his way through the ranks of organized crime in the 1920s and 30s in Prohibition to become a power in the crime family of Lucky Luciano. And later, and when Luciano got deported, vied for power with Frank Costello over control of that clan, as it were. And ultimately, it was Vito who won out over Costello and became the namesake of the crime family, which today bears his name.
Now, he sort of made his bones in New York, committing all sorts of crimes, as you mentioned, and doing a lot of things that mafia people would do. Then he goes back to Italy. He goes back to Italy and spends some time there during Mussolini's fascist regime. Why did Genovese go back to Italy, and why did he come back to the United States?
Well, in 1934, when Vito was in New York, actually he was living in New Jersey at the time, he was a suspect in a murder case. Him and some of his other compadre out of Little Italy. And he booked to Italy and got out of there just as things were starting to get very tight in terms of the investigation. And he went to Italy and took a – that was a strange time to go. Think about it.
Yeah.
Because Mussolini had been having his own war against the mafia over there with the Iron Prefect, commander who's – went after the mafia. So Genovese goes over there. And he goes over there with a lot of money, and he became a benefactor of the local fascist party in the area around Naples, and ingratiated himself not only with the fascists, but also with Mussolini and Mussolini's immediate family, one of them being Count Ciano, who was Mussolini's brother, son-in-law, and became his foreign minister. So Genovese, you know, knew where his bread was buttered, and he knew who the powers were, and he knew how to circle up and, you know, get close to the people with the power and close to Mussolini. So he really had a blank check over there to do what he wanted, even though the mafia was in disfavor.
So then why come back? Why come back if he was doing so well in Italy financially and was so close to the fascist regime? Why come back to the United States?
What happened was, of course, and this is the Italian history here with Mussolini. Mussolini fell out of disfavor in about 1943, and he was really basically deposed from power and had to be rescued by the Germans and put up in a puppet state in northern Italy. So Genovese, you know, knowing where the power now is changing, saddled up to the Americans and actually worked as an interpreter for them as the Americans were pushing up the spine of Italy, you know, in the invasion. But at some point, it became clear to the American authorities that Genovese was running a big black market operation involving American soldiers and American trucks. And they arrested him. And they ultimately found out from the American law enforcement back in the States that he was wanted for that murder case from 1934. So essentially, he was deported, if you want to call it that, from Italy right after World War II, at the tail end of it, 1945, 1946. That's what happened. He had to come back.
You're right about
he was deported.
You're right about this narcotics empire that he brought to power in the United States and helped make international. A lot of the code of the mafia, a lot of the oath that you have to pledge involves, even to this day, involves not dealing in narcotics. How could such a legendary mafia figure, the namesake of one of the mafia families in New York, have been such a prominent part in something that was such a violation of the mafia's rules?
Well, the short answer is, Frank, and I think you probably are aware of this as well, is that that rule or command was kind of a fiction. We all know that the crime families today and in the past were dealing in drugs. It was kind of a yes, we know what the rule was supposed to be, but they were all dealing in drugs. They were all dealing in narcotics in significant ways. Now, Genovese, to the day he died, swore he wasn't involved in that big narcotics operation. But, you know, the intelligence was that his people were certainly involved. So either he had, he turned the other way, or he was more deeply involved as the feds thought he was. But the fact of the matter is, you know, this notion that the mafia doesn't deal in drugs is really a big fiction. And it's been a fiction for decades.
Talking with Anthony DiStefano, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author. His latest book is The Deadly Don, Vito Genovese, Mafia Boss. It's clear that becoming the top dog when it comes to the mafia was a big deal to Vito Genovese. He was aspiring of being the capo di tutti i capi, boss of all bosses in the American mafia, and he betrayed some of the mafia's other most prominent figures at the time, including Frank Costello, who you wrote about in that book. Tell folks about why this mattered. Why did he need to become not just a mafia boss, but the mafia boss, and how close he came?
Well, the thing with Vito Genovese was that I think he had this inferiority complex next to people like Luciano and Costello. Luciano, in his book, said that he really hated Genovese and really supposedly gave him a beating, which is a hard thing to sort of grasp and understand. But he also felt that he wasn't getting his due in the crime family, because he had people like Costello, who were the smooth operators, who were tied into politicians. They had legitimate businesses. Now, Vito had his own legitimate business, but he really wasn't very successful in it. Costello was kind of like a marquee guy who he always felt second fiddle to. So I think he really had that inferiority complex that he had to overcome, and hence he pushed himself and, you know, ultimately had more muscle than Costello had, and got rid of Costello. And he didn't kill him, as you know, but he got him to retire after that abortive assassination attempt.
And then what about his efforts to become the capo di tutti i capi? Was he successful? Did he ultimately get that title?
He, in his own mind, he did, but it was very short-lived, because after Costello retired, they had the meeting in Appalachia, which Genovese, you know, lobbied for and wanted all the crime families to meet upstate, and that turned out to be a disaster. It turned out to be a disaster for Genovese and all the other mafia bosses, because suddenly the FBI and the public became very aware of organized crime, and the attention the legal trouble that some of these mafiosi had because of Genovese's insistence on this meeting really put him in bad stead with some of his people and some of the other crime bosses.
We do Godfather trivia on this show from time to time, and it's been said that Vito Genovese might have been the basis for Vito Corleone in The Godfather. Any truth to that?
I've heard Frank Costello being the model, so to speak, for Don Corleone and The Godfather. If you look at it, there's more to the Costello angle, because Costello had the political connections that Don Corleone had. He had more of a successful business empire, as did Don Corleone. Vito, I don't think, had that kind of political heft and connection that we saw in The Godfather. But look, who's to say that some elements of Vito Genovese's life may have inspired Puzo?
Why write this book, Tony? Of all the mafia figures you could write about, past or present, and you've written about many, why did you choose to focus on Vito Genovese?
There hadn't been a good book, a complete book, written about Vito Genovese in over 50 years. The last one was in the 1950s by a Journal American reporter by the name of Dom Frasca, and who had a special entree to Vito. I think one of his relatives was an associate of Vito. In the 50s, we didn't have the information that we have now in 2000, 2020, when I was putting this book together. I was able to find Vito's, to answer the caller before, where did I get this information from? Who told me anything? Some of this is from Vito's own words. I found material and depositions that Vito gave in certain cases in his criminal background, especially his immigration case, where he talked about his own life and some of his criminal cases and what went on in his life and his family, his wives, his children, and, you know, I'm getting this from him. So we have this period of time now where the record keeping and the access to records is much greater than we had in the 1950s. We didn't have the stuff we didn't have what we have now back in the 50s. So a reporter or writer back then was someone at a disadvantage. And I was able to exploit that, the new access to information that we now have.
How did it all end for Vito Genovese? What was his trial like? What was he ultimately convicted of? And then what was his time in prison like?
Yeah, in the late 1950s, he was convicted of a narcotic conspiracy. And like I said, he swore to the day he died he was framed. There was one tenuous conversation that kind of linked him to the informant, but it was enough, along with everything else. He was convicted of the conspiracy, sentenced to 15 years in federal jail, a federal penitentiary, and died from various heart ailments in prison. And he never got out. He was probably within 5 years of getting out, but that's what happened to him. He died in prison.
For a lot of people listening to us now, the name most synonymous with the Genovese crime family isn't necessarily Vito Genovese. It's Vincent the Chin Gigante. I'm wondering if you can describe a little bit the relationship between Vito Genovese and Vincent Gigante.
Vinny the Chin was an acolyte, I call him, of Vito Genovese. Vito Genovese got the Chin, so the story goes, to take that shot at Costello in that apartment building, his apartment building in Central Park West. And it was Vinny the Chin who was supposedly the would-be assassin. So the relationship between Genovese and the Chin was significant. And they also were involved in a narcotics case together, and they got convicted together. So there was a tight connection.
Lastly, a lot of people are going to be hearing this story and wondering about the status of the American mafia these days, Tony. Based on your analysis and observation, how strong is the mafia, the La Cosa Nostra, these days in the United States?
I don't think it's as strong as it once was. I think the heyday may have been, in the last analysis, probably in the 1980s, but they're, I think, reconstituting themselves. I think the Sicilian elements that have come over here are, in some ways, trying to reconstitute the families and, you know, become more secretive and more cloistered. The Genovese crime family, from what I'd learned from law enforcement and other people, is probably the strongest of them right now, followed by the Gambino crime family. But, you know, you got these families in Italy, the 'Ndrangheta, which is very powerful and very into narcotics trafficking around the world. They're really supplanting the American mafia in many ways.
Tony, we're going to have to leave it there. I very much appreciate the time. I hope people check out the book, The Deadly Don. Vito Genovese, mafia boss Anthony DiStefano is the author. It's available wherever books are sold. Let's do it again soon, Tony.
Yes, and Frank, take care of yourself and don't drive drowsy.
Never! This is The Other Side of Midnight. Help control the pet population. Get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everybody, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. I think they may end up changing the year 2021, the official name of it, or at least maybe a nickname of it, to the Year of Living Mandatory. Every day that you open the newspaper, turn on the television, turn on the radio, there's a discussion of mandatory, 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 mandatory masks, mandatory vaccinations, mandatory testing. And we are still seeing quite a debate about a lot of that. And that very much was on display in New York City yesterday. Mayor Bill de Blasio, look, again, I want to reiterate that between 97% and 99% of the people who are dying from this new COVID variant, the Delta variant, they are people that have not been getting the vaccination. So to me, you look at those numbers, and again, I'm a big believer that people should make their own decisions about their own health and talk to their doctor and make a decision with their doctor. Don't take advice from people on the radio. Now, I have been very opposed to any return of the mask mandate, including for people that are unvaccinated, because my thinking is that that would actually cause fewer people to be vaccinated. You talk about a carrot and stick approach. The carrot should be that you get vaccinated and you get to live your normal life again. It shouldn't be you get vaccinated and you get to live in 2019 again or 2020 again. So Mayor Bill de Blasio is, and he's pretty much said the same thing. He is not imposing a new mask mandate because he's concerned it would prevent New Yorkers from getting vaccinated. He said, and he must be listening to this show. I wish he'd take more than just masking policy advice from me. But he said, I fear this. I don't want to see people say, oh, we're wearing masks, so we don't need to deal with the vaccination. He said that on Tuesday. He's exactly right. That's crazy. That evades the main point. Somehow we're having a national dialogue that has become insane. This was the mayor yesterday.
The problem is the misinformation and the fact that people are buying into it. You know, at a certain point, personal responsibility actually matters.
Well said. He continued.
Why is this hard? Just go get vaccinated. This is not difficult. And there's so much just horrible rumor and falsehood and lies out there.
So the question that a lot of people have had is why are so many people that work in the healthcare sector, doctors, nurses, you name it, nurse prescriptives, nurse practitioners. Why are so many people that work in hospitals and in doctors' office not getting vaccinated? Some estimates that I've seen are as high as a third of medical professionals don't want to get vaccinated. And now the question becomes, what about mandatory vaccination? Well, the mayor came out with another policy proposal yesterday, and it's one of those things where if you only read the headline, you'd think one thing, but if you read the article, you would actually think something very different. Now, just so you know where I'm coming from, I'm opposed to mandatory vaccinations. I'm opposed for mandatory vaccinations for people that work in a hospital or people that work in an office, primarily for a couple reasons. One, based on a lot of what we know, based on a lot of what the science suggests, if you've already had the virus and you've recovered from it, chances are you have immunity that could be just as strong or even stronger than people that get the vaccination. So if you're a young, healthy person and you've already recovered from the virus, are we really going to mandate that you need to go out and get the vaccine and maybe feel crummy for a day? No, I don't think we are. Also, a lot of people are going to have medical issues. My wife, for instance, my wife is with child. Her doctor told her not to get vaccinated. And I think she should listen to her doctor. So a lot of people are going to have issues with that involve them not wanting to get vaccinated. I think the best defense that you can have is to get vaccinated yourself. Now, I'm not going so far as Brian Kilmeade did on Fox News the other day, where he said, and I agree with about 90% of what he said, but he basically said not getting vaccinated is the equivalent of going cliff diving. I'm not going to stop someone who wants to go cliff diving. I'll tell them I don't think it's a good idea if they ask me. But look, it's your choice, and it's your choice not to get vaccinated. It's your decision. And he's right, but he's wrong. Now, again, as we've said, we've seen all these Democrats that fled the Texas state legislature to stop them from passing an election bill. We've seen six of them now come down with COVID, even though they were vaccinated. If you get the vaccine, that doesn't mean you can never get COVID. That means it gives you 90% protection, roughly, depending on what vaccine you get. And everybody's a little different, sure. And if you're encountering people that are unvaccinated, and you keep encountering those people, not only do your chances of getting the virus go up, but it delays herd immunity. Now, Mayor de Blasio came out yesterday. This is what the headline in the New York Post as of 5:39 p.m. last night said. De Blasio to mandate COVID vaccinations for public hospital staff. Whoa! I see that headline. That made me sit up straight and take note. Whoa! Mandating vaccinations for public hospital staff, people that presumably are medical professionals. And then you read the very first sentence, and this is what it says. Mayor Bill de Blasio, this is from the New York Post, Mayor Bill de Blasio will mandate that employees of the city's public health and hospital clinic systems be vaccinated for the coronavirus or submit to weekly testing for COVID-19, the Post has learned. Now, you talk about anticlimactic. Now, weekly testing, if you're not vaccinated, that's not a big deal. Before they had vaccines here, we used to have to be submitted to weekly tests every week. In fact, if you're not vaccinated, I want you submitted to weekly tests every week. I want to know who the people with COVID are so I can keep my distance. There's nothing wrong with this policy. This is not draconian. He's not mandating vaccines. He's mandating a vaccination or a test. Nothing wrong with that. Do you really want a nurse or a doctor that's tested positive for COVID treating a patient, especially someone that's elderly or immunocompromised or obese? Of course you don't. So I think this is a very sound policy on the part of the mayor, and I think that it makes perfect sense. And it's, quite frankly, not that big a deal. It's kind of where we were as a radio station 10 months ago. We had to be tested every week. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't want to get tested? Get the vaccine. Boom. 800-848-WABC. You're welcome to disagree. There's one other study that I took note of today. COVID-19 risk-taking is going up as people become more desensitized to pandemic life. COVID-19's been headline news for over a year. Although the virus is still out there and new cases come in every day, a new study finds the public is starting to tune out coronavirus updates. That is according to researchers from the University of California, Davis, who say society is becoming desensitized to the health crisis, especially when it comes to following pandemic-era safety measures. Their study looked at both COVID news articles and reaction to these updates on Twitter to see how the public's attitudes are changing since early 2020. And the researchers said that despite the death toll continuing to rise, people are generally showing less concern about COVID-related news. Well, of course they are. One, because we've been hearing about this for over a year. And two, because most people think that once they get the vaccine, they don't have anything to worry about. I'd say that's mostly my view. It's a drastic change, according to this research, from where the world was a year ago. In the spring of 2020, many people started to hoard essential supplies like toilet paper, panic buying whatever items they could. And so one of the communications doctoral students says that's no longer the case. In fact, the findings reveal people are now shifting back to risky social behavior and are less fearful of ignoring pandemic measures like social distancing. You know what I say to this? Good. You know what I say to this? Great. We want people getting back to normal. We want people living life normally, especially if they've gotten the vaccine. I have noticed this in every aspect of life. People are coming to work again. You know how long it takes me to get to work now? I used to fly in 45 to 50 minutes. Now it's taken me between an hour and 10 minutes and an hour and a half every night to get to work. That's a sign that New York certainly is back to normal. And some aspects of normality aren't great. For instance, it was great to use COVID as an excuse not to have to go to anything. Now I'm back to the days of I'm getting invited to five or six things a day that I have to say no to. It was nice when all these events were virtual. It was nice. I mean, it was nice and it wasn't nice. It was nice in that I didn't have to leave the house, but it was not nice in that I had to go out. I didn't get to see people. But the other thing is I'm even seeing some behaviors that are quite alarming go back to normal. I was in a men's room in a hotel recently, and I noticed multiple people leave the men's room without washing their hands. Multiple people, not one, multiple. And I noticed, and this was at another hotel, I noticed other people wash their hands and not use soap. They would just run their hands under the water, and then they'd dry them and walk out. But can you imagine? People were not doing that a year ago. People were washing their hands 5-6 times a day. So that's kind of the latest news, is that this new survey shows that Americans have now become desensitized to pandemic life, and that Mayor de Blasio is going to be instituting either mandatory vaccines or weekly testing. I think that's just fine. I think that's all good news. And I'll tell you what I found incredibly compelling. And if you follow the news and if you listen to this radio station, you've probably heard a portion of this because it's just talk radio gold. That is the discussion that took place on the Capitol Hill between Senator Rand Paul and Dr. Anthony Fauci. Now, there's so many people that are putting their spin on this. This was great television and great radio. And again, for me, the guy that always tries to be high-minded and say we should comment on more substantive things, leave it to me, of course, to find the aspect of the news day that's most like a professional wrestling promo, and then think that's what's the thing to highlight. But I found this incredibly compelling. I thought Rand Paul brought up some good points. I thought Anthony Fauci brought up some good points. So rather than listen to everybody spin, I figured I'd play for you the whole 5 minutes and let you decide for yourself, because I tell you, it's engaging as heck. I learned a lot from both of them. I don't know who's telling the truth and who's not. I suspect Rand Paul's version of events is closer to the truth. He seems to have documentation to back up what he's saying, whereas I don't think Anthony Fauci does. Anthony Fauci almost seems to be doing the Clinton-esque, it depends what the definition of the word is, only in this case, he's saying it depends on what the definition of the word, of the term gain of function research is. But this is just about the whole thing. The only things I cut out were, there was a portion where Dr. Fauci's microphone wasn't working, so I cut that out. And then a little bit of Rand Paul's preamble about Dr. Fauci's prior testimony before Congress and some other supporting documentation that he believes dispute what Fauci was saying. But listen to this and then give me your thoughts at 800-848-9222. Anthony Fauci, Rand Paul, yesterday.
In this paper, Dr. Xi credits the NIH and lists the actual number of the grant that she was given by the NIH. In this paper, she took two bat coronavirus genes, spike genes, and combined them with a SARS-related backbone to create new viruses that are not found in nature. These lab-created viruses were then shown to replicate in humans. These experiments combine genetic information from different coronaviruses that infect animals but not humans to create novel artificial viruses able to infect human cells. Viruses that in nature only infect animals were manipulated in the Wuhan lab to gain the function of infecting humans. This research fits the definition of the research that the NIH said was subject to the pause in 2014 to 2017, a pause in funding on gain of function. But the NIH failed to recognize this, defines it away, and it never came under any scrutiny. Dr. Richard E. Bright, a molecular biologist from Rutgers, described this research in Wuhan as, "The Wuhan lab used NIH funding to construct novel chimeric SARS-related coronaviruses able to infect human cells and laboratory animals. This is high-risk research that creates new potential pandemic pathogens that exist only in the lab, not in nature. This research matches, these are Dr. Ebright's words, this research matches, indeed epitomizes, the definition of gain-of-function research done entirely in Wuhan, for which there was supposed to be a federal pause. Dr. Fauci, knowing that it is a crime to lie to Congress, do you wish to retract your statement of May 11th where you claimed that the NIH never funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan?
Senator Paul, I have never lied before the Congress, and I do not retract that statement. This paper that you are referring to was judged by qualified staff up and down the chain as not being gain of function. So what was? Let me finish.
You take an animal virus and you increase its transmissibility to humans.
Right.
You're saying that's not gain of function?
Yeah, that is correct. And Senator Paul, you do not know what you are talking about, quite frankly. And I want to say that officially. You do not know what you are talking about.
Let's
okay, you get
NIH,
one person.
Let's read from the NIH definition of gain of function. This is your definition that you guys wrote. It says that scientific research that increases the transmissibility among mammals is gain of function. They took animal viruses that only occur in animals, and they increased their transmissibility to humans. How you can say that is not gain of function?
It is not.
It's a dance, and you're dancing around this because you're trying to obscure responsibility for 4 million people dying around the world from a pandemic.
And let's send Dr. Fauci.
I have to, well, now you're getting into something. If the point that you are making is that the grant that was funded as a subaward from EcoHealth to Wuhan created SARS-CoV-2. That's where you are getting. Let me finish.
We don't know.
Well,
we don't
wait
know
a minute.
It did come from the lab, but all the evidence is pointing that it came from the lab. And there will be responsibility for those who funded the lab, including yourself.
I totally
this committee
resent,
will allow the witness to respond.
I totally resent the lie that you are now propagating, Senator, because if you look at the viruses that were used in the experiments that were given in the annual reports that were published in the literature, it is molecularly impossible.
No one's saying those viruses caused it.
It
no
is molecularly.
Those viruses caused the pandemic. What we're alleging is that gain of function research was going on in that lab and NIH funded it.
That
you
is
can't
not.
Get away from it. It meets your definition and you are obfuscating the truth.
I'm not obfuscating the truth. You are the one.
Time has expired, but I will allow the witness to.
Let me just finish. I want everyone to understand that if you look at those viruses, and that's judged by qualified virologists and evolutionary biologists, those viruses are molecularly impossible
no one's
to result
they are. No
in
one's
SARS-CoV-2.
Those viruses caused the pandemic. We're saying they are gain-of-function viruses because they were animal viruses that became more transmissible in human, and you funded it.
And you
admit the truth.
And you implying.
Senator Paul, your time has expired, and I will allow witnesses who come before this committee to respond.
And you are implying that what we did was responsible for the deaths of individual. I totally resent
and it could
that.
Have been.
And if anybody
and it could
is lying
been.
Here, Senator, it is you.
Whoa! My goodness, that was something. Who do you think got the better end of that exchange? 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. I'd also love to hear your thoughts on this new proposal, not proposal, mandate from Mayor de Blasio that you either have to get vaccinated if you work at a public hospital or you have to submit to weekly tests. I'll tell you, whatever the case may be about your vaccination status, there is...
Say to myself, self, why are you awake again at 1 a.m.? Standing with the fridge wide open, staring, such a sight, fluorescent light. The stars are bright, might make a wish if I believed in them. As it is, I might watch TV, because it's nice to see people more messed up than me.
Ever asked yourself, why are you awake at this time? This song has got to be your anthem. I'll tell you, yesterday I told you the incredible true story of this this drink, this water with lime and mint, fresh mint, that our telephone talent coordinator Molly brought me. So you could tell she's campaigning for the full-time position by bringing in fresh mint and lime, you know, so like, you know, like she's running for office. You know, she, this is my mint and I approve this message. Today she comes into the studio just moments ago with a cup. And I said, oh my, this is going to be a nice treat. I'm going to get to try mint and lime again. And lo and behold, it's not mint and lime, but instead cinnamon and orange. Molly, what is this concoction? Tell me about this.
So I can't take credit for this. This is something that I was served in my college dining hall, believe it or not. So shout out to my university for spending money on cinnamon sticks instead of new cameras for our comm department. But
and remind folks, where did you go again?
I was down at Monmouth University.
Monmouth, okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is good. Now, this cinnamon is store-bought cinnamon? It's not freshly grown from your boyfriend's garden or anything?
No, this is bodega cinnamon.
Bodega cinnamon?
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, so far, the couple sips that I have, it is bodacious, I must say. 800-848-9222. Christian, did you try this?
Yes, I'm on my second cup.
It's pretty good.
It is very good. Yeah. I actually think it's better than the mint and lime yesterday.
Yeah, well, what do you know? 1-800-848-WABC. Gino is in the Brooklyn. Hello, Gino.
Brooklyn. Hello, sir. You know, this wet market theory that you haven't heard about anymore. Remember at the beginning of this whole pandemic?
Yes,
talked
yes.
About the wet market and how it transmuted from, you know, animals to humans. You know, there's an interest in America to promote this. You know, people think China is our enemy, right? But the reality is America pays for, finances, sets up laboratories in third world countries so we can do immoral, illegal testing like this. Right, this thing was funded by us. Of course, it was. It's an, you know, an act of bioterror. But the reality is, we do these things in other countries because we couldn't get away with doing it here. That's what happens. And don't be surprised if in another 6 months you see a whole bunch of lab-grown millennials that were, you know, raised in a lab someplace else, because that would be unheard of, you know, unethical research.
Gino, it's
but
such
this is what we do.
It's such a good point, Gino. And it's, we now know that a lot of the reason that we had these CIA black ops sites in other countries where CIA people could basically take enemy combatants and or enemy detainees and torture them is because we didn't want it happening in the United States. So I think it's naive to think that that would apply to torture and interrogation, but not medical science. I think it's a great point you raised, Gino.
Absolutely. And, you know, don't be surprised when more of these things come out.
Gino, that's...
And the real question to me is, was this released intentionally or accidentally or maybe by some employee that was aggrieved some way or another? How it got out, that will be one of the mysteries of human history. But how it got released into the public is a whole different ordeal. But don't blame this on some wet market. That's ridiculous.
Well, Gino, and what's so disturbing is that if you were to have said just what you just said in this phone call on social media 6 or 7 months ago, that would have been enough to get that post taken down, and it could have been enough to get your account suspended. And yet now a lot of what you say has been the view of other prominent people, and it's becoming the consensus in the medical community. And even if it's not, what's wrong with raising those questions? I think it goes to show the importance of these social media companies trying to have a real dialogue about this stuff, getting answers to some of the questions that you raise, rather than trying to stifle discussion and debate about this. Great call, Gino. Thank you. Call again. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Tom in Boston. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Frank. How are you doing?
Great. How about you?
I don't trust anything Dr. Franken or his brother, Dr. Fauci Stein, says. He knew it was the wet market. It wasn't the wet market. He knew it was written at a virology place in Wuhan. He knew that. This guy is as phony as a $3 bill. I'm glad that... Senator Rand Paul nailed him, because I think he's an awful person.
Well, look,
he pushed the wet market and everything. He knew exactly what was going on.
If you listen to Dr. Fauci's response, and thanks for the call, Tom, he doesn't say what Rand Paul is saying is factually inaccurate. He seems to take issue with Rand Paul's definition of gain of function research. He's not questioning the series of events that Rand Paul cites in that memo. He's questioning whether or not that amounts to gain of function research. And then by extension, if it's not gain of function research, then he was technically telling the truth when he testified before Congress previously. Again, it's a lot of, it depends on what the definition of the word is. 800-848-WABC. Pedro is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Pedro.
Good morrow, Frank. How you doing?
I'm doing right. Just great. Thank you.
Yeah, my question to you, yes, is do you believe this is the American mafia no longer exists, or it's in its waning years because of the Russians and the Chinese and the Albanians?
Well, I'll go along with Tony DiStefano's description. I think it certainly still exists, but I think it's a great deal less powerful and less influential than it was even 30 or 40 years ago.
Right, because, you know, there's a romanticism, you know, I'm not justifying it in any way, but there was a romanticism with the way the mob handled certain things. There's no romanticism with the Russians or the Chinese. It's like, you, step here, pow, that's it, you're gone, you know? So I just wondered about it.
Yeah. No, I think this is a pretty interesting book. If you're interested in the history, I do recommend it. Again, it's called The Deadly Don, Vito Genovese, Mafia Boss. Thanks for the call, Pedro. 800-848-WABC. Rosemary is in the Hudson Valley. Hello, Rosemary.
Hi, Frank. Could I talk about a couple of things? Because I want to answer your question you were asking about, like, that debate. I think it was like a draw. But I'm not sure. But do you know if Senator Paul, I think he has some kind of medical background.
Yeah, he was a doctor.
He's really very articulate.
He was an ophthalmologist. I think he's a graduate of medical school at Duke.
Well, he's no dummy. I mean, he really went head to head with him. And the thing I originally called about before you asked that was, I'm like stunned that the medical professionals, so many of them, don't want to take, it's like almost counterintuitive that they don't want to take the vaccination. That's all I had to say.
Well, thank you, Rosemary. First of all, keep in mind that a lot of these medical professionals, and they've called me before, and if some people want to call me now and explain why they're not taking the vaccine, if you're a medical professional, I'd love to hear from you. But a lot of these people have already had the virus. So if you've already had the virus and you've recovered from it, I question whether you even need to get the vaccine. In fact, I think you probably don't. That's been an issue between Rand Paul and others previously as well. But again, I'm a big believer. Make the decisions necessary for your own health in consultation with a doctor that you trust. Don't listen to stuff that you read on the internet or hear on the radio. Talk to your doctor. All right. I will tell you, if you're interested in healing, a great way to do that physically is by patronizing Trinity Rehab. They have something there called the EPAP machine. These folks will restore your freedom to live your life pain-free. It's not your father's physical therapy. It's cutting edge and it's state of the art. The EPAP machine is an FDA-approved non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. Breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing. It gets rid of pain fast, like back pain, neck pain, tennis elbow, shoulder tendonitis, knee pain, plantar fasciitis like Joe Borelli suffers from each day. Whatever the case may be, no prescription needed to get started. All over New Jersey. Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, Woodbridge. So before you turn to surgery or strong prescription pain medications, try the good folks over at Trinity Rehab. Call them today, 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977. Or go to trinity-rehab.com. WABC.
and high, sailing through the wide blue yonder. It's that airmail special on the fly. Listen to the motors humming, see her streaking through the sky, like a bird that's flying homeward. It's that airmail special on the fly.
Jim and Jesse, airmail special. I'm a little bit behind in my snail mail correspondence, so those of you who are waiting for a written response to me from something, just hang tight, and we will, you know, we'll be in touch. If you ever want to send me snail mail, you're certainly welcome to do that. You could send anything you want here, especially if you want to give a little tip to Christian and me and to Molly. You can send it to P.O. Box 1777, New York, New York, 10163. Just send it to my attention. So, again, that's P.O. Box 1777, attention, Frank Morano, New York, New York, 10163. I am hoping to have some time this weekend. You know, I think just about every weekend in the summer, both so far and in the future, we're booked with stuff. We've got plans to be somewhere, and it's all good things. It's this occasion, that occasion. It's all fun. But, I mean, it all gets to be a bit much. You know, it's like that old Sinatra song goes, it's nice to go traveling, but it's so much nicer to come home. And I think this weekend we only have two events. I hate to say it, only two events. But I don't think I have anything planned Friday. I was going to work on, because I've been just on such a hot streak gambling-wise, I was going to work on trying to go to Atlantic City on Friday or Saturday. But the rooms are just crazy. There's no rooms anywhere in town. I think I'm going to have to go for a weekday trip there soon in order to keep my hot streak going. But I couldn't get a room anywhere Friday or Saturday, not for less than an arm and a leg. Then Saturday, we're scheduled to visit our friends in Manalapan, New Jersey, the Simonettis. But I think that's like a 2 or 3 hour visit, and it's not far. So I'll still have the morning to catch up on some correspondence, work on the show a little bit, maybe do some reading. Sunday, the only thing we have on our agenda is we're having sort of a family party for my brother's PhD. He got his PhD a few months ago, and our cousins are coming over, and everybody will be over. So hopefully that's it, and it could be a nice, relaxing, restful weekend. I'll catch up on some reading, and maybe even watch a motion picture, which I have not done. You've noticed we haven't had any movie reviews in a while because I haven't seen a film in weeks. So I will tell you, a lot of you have been curious and asking about the situation with our cat Melchizedek, who when last seen was urinating and defecating in the bathtub on a daily basis. Well, we told you that we took him to the vet and there was nothing physically wrong with him. His issues are all psychological, which, if you've ever met Melchizedek, will come as no surprise to you. And as of this broadcast, he is still, just about every day, urinating and or defecating in the bathtub. So yesterday, and now he's very brazen about it. Yesterday he was, or 2 days ago, he was going in the bathroom, and he made a motion. The shower curtain was blocking him. So he made a motion almost as if he was waiting for somebody. My wife was right near there, so I guess it was her. He made a motion as if he wanted her to open the shower curtain so he'd have an easier time getting in there. He just looks at her like, oh, this is where I go now. So come on, help me out. No shame, no hiding. He was very brazen about it. So as of yesterday, my wife got a second litter box and put it in that bathtub. And sure enough, as of now, he is going in the litter box in the bathtub. So, again, I'd prefer if he went in the litter box with everybody else, but at least he's going in the litter box in the bathtub, which makes cleanup a lot easier. So good for him. We're happy for him. 800-848-WABC. Tom is in Blue Point.
Good evening.
Tom, I love your oysters. Hello.
County Cork, Vesper BlackRock, gave 28 years to U.S. intelligence. Frank, we're in trouble. I want to know, why is my commander-in-chief not at the border? How come? And what did the vice president accomplish? What did she accomplish besides cackling? And the second thing I have to say is we just spent $35 million on a toll booth. I used to be in Border Patrol, okay? We just spent $35 million on a toll booth in Afghanistan. We're pulling out. We tell the whole world who's moving in. Iranian National Guard, ISIS, Iraq, Iran, troublemakers. So what do you say? What say you?
Well, again, Tom, you may be confusing me for someone that has conversations with President Biden on a regular basis, but I can answer your first question in terms of why President Biden is not going to the border. The president doesn't consult me. I don't think he listens to me. As far as your second question, what did the vice president accomplish at the border? I don't think she accomplished much of anything. I think it was all for show. It was all kind of a dog and pony show, and it's evidenced by the fact that we still have record apprehensions at the border. Just think of all the people that are still making their way through. And as far as your third question, look, I think as President Trump indicated he was for during the campaign, I think we should have left Afghanistan 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. As far as the Iranians moving in,
agree 100%.
I think that is actually potentially a net positive to the United States, because if you look at one of the things that Iran is most afraid of, they are incredibly threatened, and you see this with Saudi Arabia, by Sunni Islamic states. Now, the last thing they want is another Sunni Islamic theocracy on their border, which is exactly what they're going to have if the Taliban takes over. So if the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is going to sort of keep the Taliban busy, or at least keep them on their toes, that's one less Sunni Islamic fundamentalist group that's working to fly a plane into a building in America. So if Iran wants to deal with those guys, I do a Pontius Pilate, wash my hands. Iran, good luck to you.
Yeah, well, Sunnis, the Shiites, they've been this is a 500-year-old war, more than that. Frank, I'm going to mail you a book. I'm sure you read it. Maybe you haven't. It used to be in every public library. None Dare Call It Treason. I'm going to mail you two books. One is written by a former Congress, the 1974, None Dare Call It Conspiracy. It'll take you 2 hours to read it. The other book, None Dare Call It Treason, was written right after Goldwater Law, 65, by Congressman Gary Allen. The exact same thing is happening today. Our government is, Frank, communism is alive and well.
I will read the book. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Rick on Long Island. Hello, Rick.
Yes. Hello, Frank. How are you? I just wanted to make a comment in regards to the de Blasio's mandate for the city hospital workers. It came as a surprise to me. I didn't even realize that that was done. I just went on the computer and confirmed that. And, you know,
well, that's why you've got to be listening to me, Rick. Think of what else you might learn if you keep listening.
Well, actually, I called in about the slippery elm for your throat. Don't know if you tried that or not.
I did order it. Yes, I did order it. I've been using it. I've been using it.
Yeah, it's pretty unique kind of sensation, I think.
It is. You're right about that.
But I do listen to you. You're great at night. I love you. But
love you too.
It's really distressing to me when you get mandates like this, and probably. You sort of hit on it very well before, and that the real issue here is not vaccination or not vaccination. It's like, do you have those antibodies or not? And, you know, I'm a healthcare worker. I had gotten the virus a year and a half ago. I didn't get the vaccination, and I just went for a health physical for school. And, you know, I requested a vitamin D level and an antibody level, but that's the real issue. I mean, it's, do you have the antibodies? It doesn't really matter how you acquired them.
Exactly.
That's the basic argument there. And no, I don't see this addressed anywhere in the media.
And my brother, who's a scientist, Rick, says that even after you lose the antibodies, even after the antibodies wear off, there's still ample evidence to suggest that you may even retain immunity even once you lose those antibodies.
I've heard that, you know, and I've even looked online now, and it's starkly missing here. Is where's the studies being done on these breakthrough cases on people who have, you know, natural antibodies versus the vaccination? I mean, there's nothing mentioned about that. And that's, you know, it's like your silence is deafening. You know?
Oh, that's a great point.
And then in terms of public administration, you get Governor Cuomo, who's mandating state students who are going back to school to get vaccinated. However, unless I'm wrong, the teachers don't need to aren't under the same mandate.
That's correct.
More,
you're right.
More than likely, these teachers are older than the students. Not always. You know, it's not a general statement, but I think it's very accurate. And they're in a higher risk category of carrying it and getting it. I mean, it's absurd.
Rick, you're right. Now, do you agree that what de Blasio is doing by saying vaccination or a negative test is not so crazy?
You know, is he saying that if you have the antibodies, no matter how you got them, you're eligible for exclusion?
No, he's saying, well, that I think would be an even sounder philosophy. But what he's saying is, if you don't get the vaccination, you're going to have to take a weekly diagnostic test to make sure you're not positive for COVID.
Oh, I would be able to function with that kind
right.
of approach.
Yeah,
I mean that's pragmatic, yes. But I mean, I'm just sort of a little bit worried. I mean, there are other people on WABC, which, you know, I know it's, sometimes it's not proper to mention them, so I won't. But, you know, a pretty simplistic philosophy, which, you know, I sort of adhere to, is, look, the vaccine's out there. Either take it if you want it, or if you don't, it's on you. I mean, and that's very, very general. And there's a lot of, you know, in the society of Oz, you know, something as complicated as what we've got, there's a lot of loopholes and people who can't get it, or, you know, there's many different exceptions to that general thing. But, yeah, I mean, basically that's... you know,
Rick, well, that's mostly my view, Rick, and thank you for the call. I got to run. But again, a vaccine doesn't give you total protection. So if you're hanging around with people that are unvaccinated, you're a little bit more likely to catch the virus, even if you've been vaccinated. But what Rick said, that's basically my approach. I'm shaking hands with people. I'm kissing people. I'm hugging people. I ain't afraid of no virus. 800-848-9222. By the way, that book, None Dare Call It Treason, from what I'm seeing, contrary to what the caller mentioned, I am seeing that the author of that book is John Stormer, not that Congressman Gary gentleman that he had mentioned, John Stormer. All right, 800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead. Song 1-800-848-WABC. Hey, you know what we're gonna do at the top of the hour? We're gonna give you a chance to win a complimentary The Other Side of Midnight baseball cap. What do you have to do? All you have to do is answer two trivia questions. Well, what category are they gonna be in? Are they gonna be in The Godfather? Are they gonna be in Star Trek? Are they gonna be in Seinfeld? Are they gonna be in presidential trivia? Here's the rub. We're gonna let you answer two questions in any category you want. If you're like Dr. Joyce Brothers and an expert in boxing, you could say boxing's your category. If you're like Sid Rosenberg, you're an expert in sports, you could say sports is your category. If you know everything there is to know about presidential trivia, you could say that's your category. Any category you want, you pick the category, and you will be able to win a hat. All you have to do is dial 1-800-848-9222 when we play Stump the Audience. All right. In the meantime, I do want to encourage, you know, I saw a list today of some of the most listened to podcasters who happen to be conservative. And, you know, I don't want to get into rank. You know, I have varying views about some of these broadcasters. Some are, I think, really good. Some are not so good. But I think the show that we're doing on a regular basis is far better. And I think if more people knew about it, you would really see us making some of these lists. Now, the way that we can get there is for you to subscribe to the podcast of this show. So what I'd like you to do right now is go to iTunes, go to Spotify, go to Google Podcasts, go to wherever you get your podcast, and type in The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Moreno and hit the subscribe button. If you have iTunes, I'd certainly appreciate it if you left a positive review as well. If you don't have any of those apps, go to fmwabc.com and keep asking questions.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everybody, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. One of my favorite things to do on the radio, and just in real life, I do this for fun in my real life, is to answer presidential trivia questions. I also love answering questions about The Godfather. I also love answering questions about Seinfeld. And the reason I like doing those things is not because I'm an expert. I mean, I think I know more than the average person, but I'm far from an expert. But because I really enjoy learning about things that I don't know. So for 5, 6, 7 months on this show, we were doing that. We were inviting listeners to come in and stump me with two questions and try to win a hat. And I thought it would be fun. I thought it would be a lot of good questions. But it ended up going in sort of a weird direction. We ended up getting a lot of repeat questions. We ended up getting a lot of things that weren't really trivia questions. And it became kind of frustrating, not only to me, but to the audience. So then we decided to give you the opportunity to win a prize by answering questions from me. And, you know, I think that was going pretty well for a couple of weeks. But then, inevitably, somebody would comment in the Facebook group, and you could join the Facebook group by just searching on Facebook, Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's M-O-R-A-N-O, Radio Fans and Haters. That's the group to be in if you want to participate in the conversations being had about this show. Inevitably, you'd have somebody say, well, no, I want to hear questions about Modern Family, or I want to hear questions about vice presidential trivia, or I want to hear questions about foreign policy, whatever. So I thought last week, and it worked pretty well, so like anything on this show, we'll stick with it until it doesn't. I thought it would be fun to let you choose the category of questions that you want to answer. And if you can answer two questions, all you have to do is tell me the category at 1-800-848-9222. Then you will win a brand new The Other Side of Midnight baseball cap, because it's time for us to play
The Other Side of Midnight presents It's Stump the Audience on 77 WABC.
It's Stump the Audience.
Yeah. Let us begin with Mike in New Jersey. Hello, Mike.
Good morning, Frank. How are you today?
Great.
Sounds good.
What is your category of choice, my friend?
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
I had sent you a YouTube link on Arnold smoking stogies. Did you ever get that?
Oh, I did see that. I didn't. I don't know that I watched it. What was the context of it? Like, what was I going to get from it?
He's explaining why he's able to smoke cigars without any repercussions.
I
find it entertaining.
Yeah, no, I will watch it. How long a video is this here?
It's about a minute or so.
All right, okay, well, I can spend a minute on it. I'll do it during the next commercial break. I have it here in front of me now.
Very good. I'll take Seinfeld, please.
Seinfeld, an oldie but a goodie. Mike has called into the show before. He knows his Seinfeld questions. All right, this is, I think, pretty easy. The front of the restaurant that's known as Monk's on the show is actually the front of what restaurant?
I'm at a loss here. I don't know.
You got to take a guess.
I'll say Arnold's.
Well, it is a person's name, but unfortunately,
wrong.
It is not Arnold's. The correct answer is Tom's. Tom's Coffee Shop. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate the effort. 800-848-WABC. If you pick the category, and I will give you a couple of questions, and if you can get them right, I will give you the Other Side of Midnight baseball cap. Let's go to Lieutenant G. Hello, Lieutenant G.
Hello, Frank.
What is your category, my friend?
The Odd Couple TV show.
Ah, The Odd Couple TV show. Not the play, not the motion picture, but the good old-fashioned TV show. Okay, a fine show it is. A fine show it is. Felix and Oscar. Okay.
Yes.
Felix and Oscar disguise themselves in order to get on Monty Hall's Let's Make a Deal. What is their disguise?
It's a horse.
Final answer?
Horse.
It is a horse. Well done. Well done. All right. You're halfway there. All right. Who owned the building that Felix and Oscar lived in?
I hope I get his name right. I think it's Rodney Allen Rippey, the child star.
Well, I am sorry, Lieutenant G, but that is absolutely right. It is Rodney Allen Rippey. Well done. Congratulations.
Thank you, Frank.
So you've already won a hat, so we're going to add to that. We're going to send you a giant case of satisfaction. 800-848-WABC. Susan is in New York City. Hello, Susan.
Good morning, Frank. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I got to tell you, you are on a hot streak this week. I love your show, but I never know what's going to happen when I turn on the radio at 3 a.m., and you are on fire.
Well, that is awfully nice of you to say, Susan. You made my morning.
I'm so glad to do that.
What is your category, Susan?
Opera.
Ah, okay. As a young girl, Oprah was so poor that she often had to wear dresses made from what?
No, not Oprah, Frank. Opera.
Oh, not Oprah. Opera.
No.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Can I make a small correction? My name is Suzanne, not Susan.
Oh, Suzanne. Okay. All right. Well, we will talk to Molly about it. She's lucky she brought in the cinnamon today. It makes me overlook some of her spelling errors. All right. Well, Suzanne, that's one of my favorite names. I've known quite a few Suzannes in my day, all of whom great people. I've yet to meet a Suzanne that is not terrific. All right. This is probably an easy question for you since you know it. Since you know the field, but this is a question that I actually got wrong on the television show Cash Cab. The La Scala Opera House is in which European city?
In Milan, Italy.
It is in Milan, Italy. All right. Nessun Dorma is an aria from which opera?
From Turandot by Puccini.
That is absolutely correct, Suzanne. Well done. Congratulations.
Right. I love getting my hat.
All right. Well, stay on hold, and Molly will be with you, and she will give you your – she will get your address and so forth and all the information necessary to get your hat. Make sure you give her the spelling of your name twice because you know, so we don't want some lady named Susan getting it, right?
Thanks a million, Frank.
All right. Sure thing. Thank you, Suzanne. 800-848-WABC. Coming up at 3:30, we're going to talk with Simon Constable, one of my favorite financial commentators. I'm looking forward to that conversation very much. Steve is in Bayside. Steve, category, please.
Godfather, Frank.
Godfather. All right, great. Love playing some Godfather trivia. Okay. All right, who said it? And I hope that their first child is a masculine child.
That would be Luca Brasi.
That is Luca Brasi. Okay. Vito meets Virgil Salazzo. He who requests Vito's help in getting his narcotics operation off the ground. He asks for $1 million in cash, legal protection, and political influence. What percentage of his revenue does he offer Vito in return?
Oh, whoa, that's a tough one.
It is indeed.
I'm going to go top of my head. I don't know. And I'm going to say 5%.
5%, pretty good deal. But yeah, not as good as 30%.
Wrong.
It is 30%. Well done, though, Steve. Well done.
Thank you, Frank.
All right. Well, 800-848-9222. If you want to play trivia, play Stump the Audience, I should say. You pick the category, whatever the category is, presidential trivia, The Godfather, Seinfeld, you name it. And if you can answer two questions, you'll win a hat. 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Mickey in Manhattan. Hello, Mickey.
Nikki.
Oh, Nikki. Okay, sorry. So you must be calling from the same phone as Suzanne.
I think so. My category is the TV show Columbo.
Columbo, a fine show. A fine show if ever there was one. All right. Columbo frequently helps himself to food found at the murder scene, often rifling through victims' cupboards, and on one occasion requesting that a rare and expensive cheese found next to a corpse be bagged to take home. What is his preferred cadaver-side snack?
Oh, the name of the cheese?
Well, no. The cheese was just an example. But oh, okay. The snack does not include the expensive cheese.
A sandwich?
Can you be more specific? It is a sandwich. But what kind of sandwich?
Oh, dear. Ham sandwich?
Ah! I was rooting for you, Nikki. It is a peanut butter and raisin sandwich. That is his favorite, his favorite snack.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Well done. Good try, I should say. 800-848-9222. Al in New Jersey. Topic, please.
The Godfather.
The Godfather. A great film and a great, great category of trivia. Okay. What does Mike drop while running to the phone box after his father has been shot?
The newspaper?
Newspaper, huh? Is that your final answer?
Yes, it is.
Well, good thing, because it's absolutely correct.
Oh, great.
All right, okay. All right. Moving on. It's too easy. It's too easy for somebody that can get that. All right. Why? All right. Who said it? We'll give you this. This is kind of easy too, but we'll give it to you. Who said this?
Give me an easy one. I want to win a hat.
Okay. We'll give you an easy one. You seem like a good guy. All right.
Okay.
Who said it? Leave the gun, take the cannolis.
Clemenza.
It was Clemenza. Very good, Al. Hang on and give Molly your information, 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Mike is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Mike, category, please.
Godfather.
Godfather, another Godfather. All right. All right. Who said this? It's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business.
Jeez, let me see here. The Don, wasn't it?
Final answer?
Yeah.
Can you be specific about which Don we're talking about?
His father, the Godfather.
Wrong. It is Michael Corleone. In the events leading up to this scene, Michael had gone to visit his father in the hospital, but realizes all the bodyguards protecting the Godfather are gone. A nurse explains they'd been sent away by the police. The police captain McCluskey shows up, and when Michael asks him how much he's being paid by Solozzo, he breaks Michael's jaw. In this scene, several members of the Corleone family are discussing how to react to the attempted assassination of Vito Corleone. The group agrees Michael will kill both Captain McCluskey and Solozzo in a meeting placed to be decided by Solozzo, which turns out to be an Italian restaurant in the Bronx. Michael says this quote, "When hot-headed Sonny implies this hit is personal." Michael says, "It's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business." Although a valiant attempt, though, Michael, a valiant attempt. 800-848-WABC. Robert in New Jersey. Category, please.
Hello?
Robert.
Yes.
Category, please.
Star Trek.
All right. Now, do you have a preference in series?
Let's go with Next Generation, I guess.
Okay, right. You like Next Generation. Okay, I like Next Generation. I like Next Generation, too. And that's probably, you know, that's a good one. Okay. Let me ask you this. Wesley verbally interacts with an alien computer that, upon his demands, displays the current locations of Enterprise civilians between, actually, this is too complicated of a question. It's too much. Let me give you another one. How about this? Star Trek: The Next Generation. Hang on. Let me find a good one here for a man of your caliber. All right, this is a good one. This is not too easy. It's not too hard. You should get this. Which Star Trek: The Original Series actor guest starred on the series premiere of Star Trek: The Next Generation?
DeForest Kelly.
That is absolutely right. Okay, that's good. Okay, we're going to find another good one here for you, Robert. That was a fine cameo, I must say. All right. Which crewman was one of the 8 crew members killed? This is a multiple choice question. We'll give it to you. Which crewman was one of the 8 crew members killed when he failed to reach the pocket of safety created by a modified phaser during a firestorm on Bursalis 3? The options are Aaron, Dang, Richardson, or Tarsus.
I'm going to say A.
You're going to say Aaron?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Robert. I had such high hopes for you. It was Richardson. Richardson was part of the team attempting to use thermal deflector units to create a firewall and give the Enterprise enough time to evacuate the colony in the path of the firestorm. All crewmen, Deng and Lieutenant Commander Darren, could do was watch when he died. A valiant effort, though. 800-848-9222. Richard is in Westchester. Richard, category, please.
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll. What category, what era of rock and roll are you most into?
They'd go 50s, 60s, I think.
All right, okay. Who's your favorite rock and roll artist?
Well, I'm a Beatles, Elvis guy.
Okay, that's good. How many Little Richard songs did Elvis Presley make covers of?
Jeez, how many?
How many?
You had Rip It Up.
Okay.
I think he did Long Tall Sally.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez, man, that's a toughie.
Oh, yes. Well, we ask the tough questions here.
I'd say that. Geez, out of my top of my head, that's, you know, Rip It Up was my favorite that Elvis did. And then Long Tall Sally, and I guess I can't get any more.
Well, you don't have to name the songs. Just tell me how many there were.
That's the only two I know.
All right, so you're going to go with two?
I have to.
Wrong. Unfortunately, my friend, you neglected to include Tutti Frutti and Ready Teddy, which Elvis did cover. So, unfortunately, you will remain hatless, Richard. Hopefully, you don't have a bald spot. All right. Well, this was fun. We're going to move on. Those of you, Ted, Brian Mitchell, and everybody else that's holding that didn't get a chance to answer some questions today, call back next week, and we will put you guys to the front of the line.
Stand about 6'4". All the downtown ladies call it treetop.
Side of midnight. We're going to talk with Simon Constable about the economy in just a minute. You realize when you go to the store now, everything costs so much. What good is having money? I mean, I'd rather have it than not have it. But I've had to develop a weekly gambling habit just to be able to pay my bills. Although something tells me that gambling habit might have developed irrespective of inflation. Now, I will tell you, got some big news yesterday. 2 days ago, I told you the incredible true story of someone that I have been texting since May. Seems friendly enough. He's inviting me to things. Or he's asking if he's going to be seeing me at things. And he did not identify himself. So, well, yesterday at 3:37 p.m., he responded to my text message about who he is. He responded to a text message I sent him Monday morning saying, "Who is this?" His response at 3:37 yesterday was, "Lou Rom." Lou is a nice enough guy who I've met a couple of times, and I now realize why I didn't have his number. He would message me on Facebook, and I hate when people message me on Facebook. It's the worst form of communicating. All right, you have text messaging. If you don't have text, who doesn't have text? But if you don't have my number, then email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. The only real reason you would ever message someone on Facebook is if you don't have their email or their phone number. So I remember he was messaging me on Facebook, and I said, "Hey, look, I don't always check Facebook. Take my number and just text me." But I guess he also gave me his, and I never saved his number. But what I assumed would happen is when he first say, "Hey, this is Lou. Appreciate you giving me your number. We'll be best pals now." Who knows how much more willing I would have been to socialize with him had I actually had his number. So, I mean, I guess we're both losers now. All right. Well, I'm glad that mystery is solved. So you're updated on the mystery texter. You're updated on the cat defecating in the bathroom. You're updated on day two without coffee. I will tell you what was so annoying. Speaking of the phone, I was at my Aunt Camille's yesterday. She calls me and said they did something. She has DVR, and I don't have DVR because there's so many great things to watch. I'm afraid I would just watch TV all day. I already think I watch too much TV, and I don't watch any. But there's not enough time in the day to watch all the great stuff that's on, especially during baseball season. So, and especially when you're taking your wife through Cheers. She made it through season 4 of Cheers yesterday. Congratulations to you, honey. Now, she calls me and said they did something to my television. And I don't know what they did, but I lost all of my recordings on the DVR. So I am not a DVR expert because I don't have a DVR. But I figure maybe, you know, my Aunt Camille's a little older. Maybe I can go there and maybe it's something that's sort of self-explanatory. So I said, all right, I'll be over tomorrow. So I was over yesterday. I'm clicking everything. I can't figure out anything. The one thing I was able to figure out is her television set was doing the thing where if you highlight an option, it talks to you. So you put the cursor over it. It says menu, settings, channel, recordings, recent activity. So I was able to figure out how to turn off that voice, which she was appreciative of. But what she really wanted was these recordings that she's been saving for years. So I couldn't figure out how to bring back her recordings. It was almost acting like they were deleted or never existed. So I call Verizon. They keep me on hold for 15, 20 minutes. And then I speak with someone who's clearly not in the United States, who sends signals. He's given me instructions. Do this, do that. Unplug this, unplug that. All right, we're going to send a signal. And after over an hour of dealing with this guy, they still couldn't get her recordings back. So it was a very frustrating experience, but I think they're lost to the sands of time at this point. But it was a good excuse to see my Aunt Camille. Hey, it's always a good excuse to talk to Simon Constable, including when inflation is going through the roof. Food inflation is going crazy. Energy inflation is going crazy. And now something that many of you use every day is going crazy. We'll tell you about it in just a minute. Simon Constable, one of my favorite financial commentators and the author of the Wall Street Journal Guide to the 50 Economic Indicators That Really Matter, joins me straight ahead.
There's an old piano and they play it hot behind the green door. Don't know what they're doing, but green they door. Laugh a lot behind the green door.
One more night
door.
Without sleeping. Why, oh, why?
They let me
maybe that's
in
why
so
you're listening to us on the radio right now. Well, look, a lot of folks very concerned about money and the economy. If you go to the grocery store, you see your dollar does not buy what it used to. If you look at the stock market, all of a sudden we're starting to see a few days where we're not reading the headline, record close, record close, record close. So what does this all mean for you? Where are things headed? And how will this Delta variant affect things? I am thrilled to reach across the Atlantic Ocean to one of my favorite financial commentators in all the world, journalist, broadcaster, and author of the book, The Wall Street Journal Guide to the 50 Economic Indicators That Really Matter. We don't have Simon Constable? So when I asked if he was connected, you said, you give me a thumbs up. Oh, okay. All right. So we're calling him then, right?
I was explaining to you, maybe I didn't hit the right IFB when I was talking, so I'll just explain it to you real quick, that when I went to go back to talk to him, he checked in and everything, and then the line dropped dead.
I see. All right. Well, so we will try to get Simon Constable, and then we'll be able to talk to him about all sorts of other interesting things, including inflation, because inflation is a real problem, and it's a problem that is quite problematic, if you know what I mean. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC if you want to talk with me until Simon joins us. And if you want to be heard on any subject, now's the time, including on inflation, because then maybe we'll be able to pick Simon's brain on that. Simon, I have you back.
Hi. Hi, Frank. I don't know what happened there.
Neither do
I. Blame the Russians.
Same. They get blamed for everything else anyway. What's one more thing? So if you, Simon, you might have missed my very flowery and elaborate introduction, but just assume.
No, I could hear every word you were saying.
Wonderful.
And thank you very much. Well, and, I'm surprised that you're going off coffee. That's a very brave thing to do.
Yes,
I wouldn't.
I'm telling you, I'm as brave as they come. All right, Simon, we hear a lot of talk about inflation. On Friday, I believe it was, or maybe it was Thursday, the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said inflation is going to be here. It's not going to be a short-term problem. We're going to have to deal with it for the foreseeable future. As far as you can tell, how bad is inflation in terms of the American economy these days?
It's not good, but it's nothing like what it was in the 1970s. Not yet, anyway. I remember going to the shops with my parents when I was a wee one in the 70s and saying, could I have that toy? And they said, well, maybe next week. I said, no, it'll be more expensive then. That's how fast prices were rising, that you knew next week was going to be more expensive than this week. And we haven't got to that point yet. But it's still pretty bad.
So you were explaining inflation to your parents even as a child?
Apparently. I would just wanted the toy now as opposed to next week, which I think all kids do. They want something now, not later. And I guess they were right. You know, have some fortitude, Simon. Wait.
All right,
wait
so
until
it may not be as bad as it was in the 70s, but there are reports that it's as bad as it's been, and it has grown faster than it has than at any time since 2008. Is that accurate from what?
Yes, it's absolutely. That's absolutely accurate. It is the highest since we had that big blip around the financial crisis. And it's really happening across the board, particularly with food, which is something I write sometimes about commodities. And we're seeing that in food in ways that are really unreal. And you mentioned energy, too. Energy prices are up. They did tumble a little bit over the last couple of days, but still way up from where they were a year ago.
And what's causing the inflation hike, particularly in the energy and food sectors?
Well, let's deal with the food sector. We've got some extreme weather happening, and we know about this in the West and in Canada. You see it on the news every night. There's a drought. There's extreme heat. We hear about that all the time. There's also been that extreme weather in other countries as well, because believe it or not, America and Canada aren't the only places that grow food. So Brazil is being affected by it. It's likely that India and Thailand will be affected by this too. So it's sort of everywhere. It's extreme weather. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of whether this is man-made global warming or not. But just to say, this is what's happening in the extreme weather. So we saw these droughts across the Midwest, the upper Midwest and Canada, causing big problems for the spring hard winter wheat crop that's coming forward and should be harvested relatively soon. That's not going to be a good harvest. It's really not. And that's going to mean the price of your bread is expensive. And worse than that, the price of pizza is likely to be affected,
oh,
which
no.
is a terrible thing. How can we live without this? So that's not good news.
And because the inflation numbers in the United States don't generally include food and energy prices, is inflation perhaps even worse than what the experts are saying?
Well, they give us two numbers for inflation. They give us a CPI, which is this consumer price index, which includes food and energy. But then most economists focus on the excluding the one that says X food and energy, because they tend to be very volatile because of things like weather. So when economists are saying it's bad, they're talking about the X food and energy. But I tend to need food and energy, and
right,
as do you, so I tend to focus. I tend to focus on what is actually happening. Now, when you exclude the big numbers,
especially
then
pizza,
the numbers get smaller. Especially pizza. I mean, who could live without that? There's it gets worse, though. There has been drought and frost in Brazil, and that is having a big impact. So if you want to have a Coke with your pizza, then you've got problems because the price of sugar is going up, and that's not good either. And worse still, for everyone in the world except Frank, coffee prices could be next.
Oh, no. Oh, that is well, look, I'll be back on coffee, I'm sure, in a week or two. But so food and food prices are going up, commodity prices, wheat, coffee, everything you just mentioned going up because of the extreme weather. One sector where we're seeing just tremendous inflation these days is in the auto sector, especially used cars. Apparently, the price of used cars on average up about 40%. What are we attributing that to?
There is a shortage of chips, microprocessors to put in cars. Cars aren't what they used to be a few decades ago, where you could actually lift up the hood of the car and get your spanner out and do some stuff with it. They're now basically big computers with wheels. And when you don't have the microprocessors available, the chips, then you can't build the cars. And that's what's causing all of this problem. So it's a supply chain problem. If you don't have microprocessors, you can't build cars. So therefore, if you want a car, you're going to have to buy a second-hand one. I mean, it's not quite as bad as that, but you get the idea.
A lot of people were taking a look at the stock market sell-off that took place on Monday and attributing that to the rise of COVID and specifically the Delta variant. Now, I know in the UK, they were opening up things this week just as the new cases of the Delta variant were skyrocketing. We're talking to you, in spite of Scotland's best efforts, from the United Kingdom right now. What exactly is the situation with COVID and its and its impact on the economy, both in the UK and the United States?
Well, first of all, I would say that although there was a lot of criticism of the U.S. government throughout the whole COVID pandemic and the way that it was dealt with, the U.S. seems to have been the best place to be on a net basis, which is really quite something. Because it was a terrible pandemic to deal with, and America's done very well. So America is basically open again.
In terms of economically, it was the best place to be economically or health-wise?
Yeah, both. I mean, America rolled out the vaccine faster than anywhere except Israel, and Israel is a relatively small country where almost everyone is militarily trained. So, you know, it's easier to get things done in a small country. Sure. where people know how to take orders. America's a big country, and it managed to roll out these vaccines really, really fast. Britain has done it okay. I'd say better than a lot of places on the continent. What happened was we've got the economy opening up in England fully, and on that day we got news that the Prime Minister and the Finance Chief both had to self-isolate because they may have been exposed to the virus, which is really bad optics. It's really, really strange thing to happen, but it did happen there and then, and we're seeing a big surge in cases across England to the extent that America says, don't go to Britain now. So we're on the list of don't goes. Wow. Along with lots of other places like North Korea. So if you want to come here, wait a few months, because actually the weather is going to be okay, I think, for a little while.
So could this uptick in the Delta variant worldwide, and if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Simon Constable. You can check out his book, which is still just as good of a read today as when it was released, The Wall Street Journal Guide to the 50 Economic Indicators That Really Matter. Could the rise of the Delta variant around the globe slow down the progress of the economic recovery internationally?
Yes, it absolutely could. The only way really to stop this is to keep giving people vaccines who haven't had it, and then give people who have had it some top-ups, because that's the way we're going to get through this. So it's continuing this massive sort of pharmaceutical race of, you know, get the jabs and stop this nonsense about anti-vaxxing. Just get it and move on. And that's the way we're gonna beat this. That's the only way.
The stock market troubles that we're seeing on the three major American indexes this week, is that a reflection of COVID concern or something else?
I think it's partly COVID, and it's partly worries that the Federal Reserve is going to start raising interest rates sooner than people originally thought, and they're going to stop printing money sooner than people originally thought, and that has a big impact on investors. Also, when you look at the prices of stocks, they've come up a long way very quickly. They went down last year, they recovered all of that, and then they've gone up much more than that. So, you know, markets just don't go up. They occasionally go down. Mostly they go up, though.
That leads me to my next question. It seems like every day I'm reading the headline that the stock market closed at a new record the previous day. And it seems to me that there are a lot of indications that we could be in some sort of a stock market bubble. Based on previous stock market bubbles, is there any indication that we could be in one that's about to burst right now?
I'd say probably not, but I'm not a very good predictor of these things, and that's something that everyone should take with a grain of salt. When somebody says, "Hey, we think this could be in a bubble," bubbles can last for a while. One thing we do know is a lot of money was saved by people during this pandemic, and particularly in America, and Americans like spending. And as the economy lifts up and as people get comfortable going back to the office, it is highly likely that they will spend a ton of money, and that will boost earnings, and that will support stock prices. I mean, it is true that the entire world economy rides on the back of American consumers. And thank goodness that American consumers spend like crazy.
That's for sure. Now, one of the things that employers, large and small, are complaining about is a labor shortage. They're having a tough time hiring people. There's plenty of job openings, and yet they are not able to hire people. Do you believe, as so many do, that this is tied to the souped-up unemployment benefits that have been included as part of the COVID relief bill?
I think there's certainly a question to answer with that. And is it indictable? Yes, there's a we could clearly have an indictment from this and say yes. Could this be a contributing factor? We can say yes, it could be a contributing factor. But there are other things. I looked at the chart of unemployment, new claims for unemployment benefits, going all the way back to the late 60s, and there was nothing on it, right? This line, it was usually about 200,000 people a month. There was this line that jumped up in sort of March and April last year to millions of people in just a few weeks claiming unemployment insurance. Companies did fire people with absolute gay abandon. Just like, oh my goodness, we're just going to fire everybody. Everybody's fired. Go away. It really showed absolutely no loyalty by some of those companies. Now, I understand why they had to do it, because they couldn't operate their businesses. But that is a trauma that millions of people will have suffered because no one likes losing their job. And when you see companies saying, well, okay, you're all gone, I don't think that's going to feel good. Now, I understand both sides of this, but I'm thinking about why aren't people going back? Maybe they're feeling like, oh my goodness, getting back into that again, where they cared about me so much, they fired me on the first day of the pandemic.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't feel good. If I was a business owner, I would probably have to do that too. And that would be a horrible thing to have to do. And I wouldn't like myself for it, but I know I would have to do it so that the business survived so I could eventually rehire people. But it just doesn't feel good. It's not a feel-good factor. The boss coming in and saying, Frank and everybody, you're all fired, won't feel good, no matter how nice that person is.
No,
and I'm
no,
sure you won't,
no,
by the way.
No, yes, God forbid. Let's not give any of our bosses any of ideas here for the next pandemic. Lastly, Simon, look, it's been a couple of years since this Wall Street Journal guide to the economic indicators that really matter was released. Don't you think it's about time for you to come out with a new book?
Yes, I do. I think it's time. I have to actually get down and type. I love writing, but yeah, absolutely. And some of the indicators no longer work because they've been distorted by things. And that's one of the great things about studying the economy, is that things that used to work in predicting don't work anymore. So, yes, I should get on there. And I'll give you an example. He used to be able to say the volumes going through the Royal Mail, which is like the U.S. Postal Service, was an indicator of economic activity. And that worked great for the whole of the 20th century, right up until when email was invented.
Right.
And then email was like, well, I don't need to send a letter. I'll just send an email. So it didn't work anymore. And there are some in the book that are a bit like that. So, yes, Robert, the co-author, and I will have to get down and get busy and get a new one out.
We'll get to it, Simon. Appreciate the early morning visit. And it's always a real treat talking with you. I always enjoy and appreciate your insight.
And good luck with staying off the coffee.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, it's an experiment. It's a way of proving to myself that I'm not a caffeine addict, I suppose, Simon.
That's a good thing.
Exactly. If you want to comment on any portion of my conversation with Simon Constable, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
I remember when Mary Lou said, "You won't walk me home from school." Well, I said, "Yes, I do." Said, "I don't have to go right home, and I would kind of like to be alone some." You would. I said, "Me too." And so we took a stroll, wound up down by the swimming hole, and she said, "Do what you want to do." I got silly and found the frog in the water by a hollow log, and I shook it at her. And I said, "This frog's for you." And she said, "I don't like spiders and snakes, and that ain't what it takes to love me." I don't like spiders and snakes.
This is Spiders and Snakes, of course, Jim Stafford. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. So yesterday was a banner day in the history of human civilization. And I don't think I'm overstating that. Because the Blue Origin rocket, courtesy of Jeff Bezos, went into space. The final frontier. I think that's pretty neat. I've been talking about it a lot. And we're doing a whole hour tomorrow morning on this with Dr. Sky, Steve Cates. And then I have some other space segments planned for tomorrow. So I figured, let me not space you to death. Let me not space you out. But I figure I should at least mention it. And someone who I just about always agree with, and one of my favorite people when she was in Congress, and somebody that I happily would have voted for president, is Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. I don't always agree with her, but I'd say I agree with her 80% to 85% of the time, which is more than I agree with most people in Congress. I thought she was a real star when she was in Congress and made a lot of sense. Very independent. So she was very – now, I get that people don't really like Jeff Bezos, and I don't really care for Jeff Bezos either, primarily because of his work with Amazon, but also some of the things that he does with the Washington Post and other things. So this is – Tulsi Gabbard tweeted yesterday, "Bezos, please stay up there. Do the world a favor." She adds, "The only problem I have with Bezos' Blue Origin space rocket ship into outer space is that it's going to come back." Now, I thought that was such a juvenile response for somebody that I always really respected for trying to elevate the dialogue in our country. And then she adds, "As the billionaires and power elite look down upon our planet, they believe they own from their heavenly perch. Regular folks struggle to pay the rent and put food on the table. Never has the divide been between the elite and the rest of us been so stark." And I get what she's saying, and I think income inequality is a big problem too. And I've spent time talking with Chuck Collins and others about it. But Jeff Bezos didn't make the rules. He benefited from them. I mean, we could talk about the, what he's done in terms of lobbying to get some of those tax loopholes and other things. But the guy became incredibly wealthy. We can discuss his methodology in becoming incredibly wealthy. The same of Elon Musk or Richard Branson. But if he's got billions of dollars and he wants to use some of that billions of dollars towards space development, I say more power to him. I say that's a great thing. And it's rare that I part company from Tulsi Gabbard, but this was one such instance. 800-848-9222 if you want to comment on anything we're discussing. Hey, you know what has exploded in popularity over the course of the last year? Christian, any idea?
I'm not sure.
You have no idea? Take a guess.
What popularity in what regard?
All right. Well, he does not want to take a guess. Molly, do you care to take a guess?
Video chatting?
Yeah, well, that's one. See, you couldn't make a guess like that.
I didn't know what you were referring to. There's a lot of things.
Well, I am going to tell you about something that has just gone crazy in popularity in addition to video chatting over the last year. And I want your help in predicting the next trend. Until next hour, your influence counts. So use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Is Frank Moreno taking you until 5 a.m. when Juliet Huddy and I bring you the news. So there has been, we've seen over the course of the pandemic, people's behaviors change, right? We've seen comebacks of a lot of different things. We've seen things that were quite popular go away. We've seen businesses struggle. The nightclub business, the comedy club business, movie theaters, and bars and restaurants come to mind most immediately. There's other businesses, Molly mentioned, video conferencing, that have exploded. Now, what about recreation? There is something that has just gone crazy in popularity over the course of the last year. It's a game. And I'll be honest, before a year ago, I had heard of this, but I don't think I had any idea what it was. Over the last year, and I don't think it's due solely to the pandemic, but I'm sure it's a factor. America has gone crazy for pickleball. They have gone crazy for pickleball. Now, if you're like me back in, now, just to give you an example, this pickleball craze is sweeping America. It has gotten so out of control. There is now a new lifestyle magazine dedicated to it, to pickleball. So publishing veteran Dick Porter has teamed up with magazine designer Jay Armus to launch a magazine called In Pickleball, a new sports and lifestyle magazine aimed at fans of the fast-growing game. The publishing duo say In Pickleball will be the Vogue of pickleball, printed on heavy stock and appealing to the mostly older and well-off Americans who live for the game. Now, Who in the world 5 years ago would have predicted the explosion of pickleball? in terms of popularity. I don't think there's a person in this audience that would have predicted it. So what I'd like to do now, if you're not familiar with pickleball, which I wasn't either, it's basically it's a paddleball sport that combines elements of badminton, table tennis, and regular tennis. I've never played it. I think I would really like it because I love ping pong. I'm still working on putting the final touches of my ping pong table together, and I'm hoping that I don't have to go anywhere too far this weekend unless, you know, my wife seems down for the unexpected last-minute trip to Atlantic City, then that I will be able to complete my ping pong table this weekend. But I think I would like it. It looks fun. But I think only, not only, but primarily wealthy people play it. But it looks like people basically playing ping pong on a tennis court. That's what it looks like to me. It looks fun, though. It looks great. So who would have predicted the explosion in pickleball years ago? I don't think there's a person. So what I'd like to do right now, with your help, is make a list of what the next trend is. What's the next thing that nobody sees coming that is going to explode in popularity? Now, it could be something that's a new product, or it could be something like pickleball that's been around for 50 years, but it's kind of waned in popularity. What is it? Could be a specific item like Tito's vodka. Or like meaning a specific brand, which just exploded. Or it could be a type of food, like sun-dried tomatoes. As Jerry said, where were they 5 years ago? Really, now at this point, it's more like 25 years ago. But seriously, it did seemingly jump onto the food scene overnight. Give me a call and tell me what the next trend is. It could be a trend in food, entertainment, housing, business, journalism, sports, fashion, politics, anything. What's the next trend? I've made a short list here, and I'm going to give you my 2 cents on what I think it might be, but I'd like to hear yours. 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. The first thing I'm going to mention, it's a food item. And you may think I'm crazy, but I do think you are going to see an explosion, even more so, of popularity in products. This already began, so maybe this is sort of cheating, but I think it's going to get much more pronounced. I think you are going to see an explosion in products containing coconut. I think coconut is the new everything. Whether it's coconut milk, coconut water, coconut butter, coconut oil, I think you are going to see coconut everywhere. One, because I think people like coconut. Two, because it's so versatile. It's the only thing you could use as almost anything. You know, I remember the first time my ex-girlfriend's mother was showing off some coconut oil. I said, "What do you do with that?" I said, "Do you cook with it?" She says, "Yeah, yeah." She throws it on the frying pan. She makes some food with it. And she says, "It's also great for your skin." And I never saw it, anything like that, where an item that you cook with, something that you could eat straight out of the jar pretty much, you could also put on your skin. And she starts rubbing it on her skin. It reminded me of that old Saturday Night Live satirical commercial, I think, with Dan Aykroyd. It's a dessert. No, it's a floor wax topic. It's a dessert. It's a floor wax topic. It's a dessert and a floor wax topic. I mean, coconut oil, what? It's something that conditions your skin. It's also something you cook with. So coconut is a food that I think is going to make a huge comeback. And I'll tell you what. You listening to Simon Constable 30 minutes ago? One of the things that we're seeing, and I don't want to get into a whole climate change discussion, but the world's getting warmer. The world is getting warmer. What does that mean? It means a lot of things. It means more flooding. It means more weird weather. It means more mosquitoes. And yes, it means more places where you can buy coconut. I do think that the fact that the earth is getting hotter is going to lead to more places where you can buy, make coconut, grow coconut, and then the dearth, the increase in coconut supply will make coconut even more affordable to everybody. I think you're going to see it everywhere. Mark my words. 5 years from now, or maybe let's say 2 years from now, 2 years from now, if you start seeing people putting coconut ketchup on their hamburger and brushing their teeth with coconut tooth polish and styling their hair with coconut hair tonic, you just remember where you heard that first. So tell your friends, coconut. That's what I'm investing in. So tell me what trends you think are next. Food, entertainment, housing, business, journalism, sports, fashion, politics, whatever. I name one. I made a list of about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9. I made a list of 8 or 9, and I'd love to hear yours. Steve in Manhattan. What do you have for us, Steve?
All right. I must be a man ahead of my time because today I had a coconut cocoa ice cream bar.
You see that, Steve? I always knew you were trendy.
Oh, yeah. I could always see around corners. Now, first of all, your interview with Simon Constable was Nixon Frostonian. And, Frank, you pull a lot of weight there. I'm making a recommendation that Molly gets an instant cash bonus and a pay raise. That's how good that girl is. Now, the gas thing I said the other night with Steve from Manhattan, is it still on the table? It'll be Talk Radio's version of Animal House. But here's my version of a trend that's coming, all right? It's a comeback after 100 years. I think people are going to have speakeasies in their house. You can't go out. You got to wear a mask and everything. They'll be getting blitzed in their houses.
Well,
people are,
that only works if there's another lockdown, though.
But they're scaring the heck out of everybody right now again with the next virus
right.
And everything.
Well, so I will go along with your trend if there's another lockdown.
Right, but people are still afraid to really gather in big crowds. I mean, it's starting to break loose and everything. But I don't want to let the Communist Party leaders who I call serial killers off the hook. I called them out last year on this. They're being protected by the establishment. What happened in Wuhan was those people were sick.
All right, Steve, I want to stick with trends.
Yeah, well, I said it.
All right, well, good. Thank you. 800-848-9222. All right, so Steve is predicting the return of the home speakeasy. Someone just sent me an SMS text message saying they're predicting the return of the Fluffernutter sandwich. I'm surprised that didn't make more of a comeback during the lockdown because I know a lot of other comfort foods did, like macaroni and cheese and so forth. What's yours? I'm going to give you one more of mine. Christian, you have any predictions, trends that are coming back? Or not necessarily coming back, but going to be big?
No, I feel like I'm always the last one to kind of jump on board with some of these trends.
Well, they say, in the words of the legendary philosopher Pete Townsend, nobody appreciates the power of a flame more than somebody that's been burned. So maybe the fact that you're always left behind will make you appreciate what you've been missing.
That's very true.
So you have
sage
nothing.
Advice. I have nothing.
All right. So you're predicting sage, a return of sage.
There you go.
Okay. Molly, what do you have?
My prediction is I think that pet clothing is going to be a
big
thing.
Okay, pet clothing. Okay.
I'll go with that.
That we've already seen a little bit of an explosion in pet clothing. Not explosion, but growth in pet clothing. So that could be, okay, pet clothing. I'm going to give you another one. And this is a game. And I was always surprised that, and we saw a brief blip on this I guess it was 2010 or 2011, the Winter Olympics, but it didn't really last. It didn't really take off. Curling. I think curling is going to really make a large impact on American life. Why? Because everybody looks at people that are curling. That's the game that you play it with basically a broom and a disc. You look at that, and everybody thinks, yeah, I could do that. I could do that. You look at people figure skating. You don't think you could figure skate. Am I right? But you look at the people that are curling. It looks pretty easy. And I think that's going to lead to a lot of people wanting to try it. So those are two of mine. Coconut and curling. Tell me what trend you're predicting. 800-848-9222. And I'll give you the rest of mine in a second. Rhea is in Highland Park. Hello, Rhea.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
I hear you perfectly.
Okay. I just wanted to share something. It's a little bit off topic of the trends. I think it's important to learn from our past and to understand what's going on. Something very concerning. Corey Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize and invented the PCR test, got his patent for 20 cycles. We're doing many more than 20 cycles, which makes a lot of noise and useless and a lot of false positives. I know someone who knows someone who works in the testing lab, and they got directions to run less cycles subsequent to the vaccine rollout. What you have here is a manufactured crisis where they can run cycles more or less times depending on the results they want to get. The reason that Japan did so well, one of the reasons, is not because they wore masks, but they did not test people who were not sick. Never in our history have we tested people who are not sick, and when people are sick, we refuse them treatment. We know there are drugs that worked. Vladimir Zelenko actually treated Honduras. The Honduras had 200 deaths total because they can't afford these expensive killing machines called ventilators, 88% death rate. Okay, and so they used his pre-hospital protocol, which is drugs that I can't mention on the phone because I don't know, they might censor your show. But there are things. Vladimir Zelenko, if you look him up, he was nominated for the Nobel Prize. And I think it's very important for people to realize not to be afraid of a new variant, because actually Luc Montagnier, the Nobel Prize winner in, I don't know, medicine or some Nobel Prize area, he actually explains that the variants are from the vaccines. And if you look at Gregory Poland, the editor of Vaccine Journal, he came to the same conclusion when vaccine strains of measles were exploding. And the conclusion he came up with was that we need different vaccines because we are actually creating problems.
So, Ray, okay, I guess it's safe to say that you're predicting that speaking at length without taking a breath is something that will become very trendy in the future.
Maybe a trend will be people will call in and stay on topic to what they told
something.
The call screener.
That was something. What did she tell you, Mom?
So I just asked, I asked the past few people that have called, what do you think will be trending soon? I usually say, what would you like to talk about? But this, when we have something very specific we're talking about, I say specifically what I'm asking. So I think I fell for her ruse.
I see. All right. Well, look, Rhea sounds like she can be very convincing. So she also sounds like somebody that talks so much that you would just agree to whatever she was saying so that you could end the conversation and get out of the room. Am I right?
100%.
Right? I mean, you got that sense, right?
I mean, I
started to kind of like follow what she was saying, and I wanted to respond to each of them, but I'm like, okay, I'm not. You could tell that was not going to end well for anybody.
No, because it was just going to keep going.
Least of all me.
Oh,
yeah. Least of all the listeners. 800-848-9222. Tell me a trend that the next year, maybe the next 2 years, is going to be big. So far, we have coconut, curling, pet clothing, the fluffernutter, the home speakeasy. I'm going to give you another one. Ready? The return of gin. Okay? Gin was the drink in the 60s, the 70s, even the early 80s. And slowly but surely, all the gin cocktails got replaced with vodka. And so much so that years ago, 30, 40 years ago, you remember the days, 30, 40 years ago, if you were to order a martini, it was just assumed. It was a gin martini. Just assumed. Nobody asked. If you wanted vodka, you'd say a dry vodka martini. Now, it's just the opposite. You go to a bar, you order a martini, they are giving you vodka. Unless you say gin. I think just as we saw the comeback of whiskeys about 7 years ago, I guess it was like 2010 to 2020 was the comeback of whiskeys. I think you're going to see that same comeback with gin. I really do. 800-848-WABC. I'll give you the rest of my list and take your calls in a minute. But looks like we have my sister-in-law's husband, Izzy, calling in from Lakewood, New Jersey. Izzy, how are you, my friend?
Good morning, Frank. How are you? I love listening to your show.
Well, thank you. What are you doing up so early?
You know, they say you got to hustle, right? You got to work up early morning, got to do your thing. Everybody does their own, but thank God for that.
No, that is absolutely, absolutely true. Do you have any trends that you want to predict for the next year?
I do believe so. I would like to actually say two of them. I believe like online shopping, you know, grocery shopping and so many things that people, you know, we were doing it for a while. But now since COVID, people were locked up in their houses. You know, online shopping is really going to be booming. I don't know if it's a thing or not. But
specifically with groceries.
Exactly.
Interesting. Interesting.
And also healthcare, like anything you need done, instead of having to go to the place, they'll come give you the service at your place.
Well, okay, that is a good one. Kind of concierge healthcare. That's a good one.
You know, like until now that like urgent care is around, they'll come to you, they'll bring you the service.
Right.
Take the COVID test at your house, for example, so on and so forth.
Right. And I will say also, Izzy, and I have to break, and I appreciate you calling, and I hope you'll call regularly. I will say you and I had a great phone conversation yesterday all about phones and how I could be paying too much for my mobile phone service. And you were telling me about the plan that you're on. And it's, you know, really a great rate that you and your wife are on. But it's AT&T, whereas I'm Verizon. And I got to tell you, I only heard about like a third of what you said in that last sentence, and I have to think that that's part of the reason why some people stick with Verizon. Is it? I feel like it does give you a better quality of mobile phone service.
So I will agree and disagree in the same sentence. I believe Verizon is a great service, and depending where you live, like some places, it works perfectly fine. Versus if you go to other towns. I mean, they're constantly building up their network. I know. I mean, I don't want to talk for them, but I do believe that I've seen, you know, having AT&T and Verizon throughout the years, that depending where you are, some places have better service than others.
Interesting. All right. Interesting. Izzy, it's great to talk with you. I hope you'll call regularly, my friend.
I did. Can I mention one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So basically, we're talking about COVID, how terrible it was. You know, we've seen in the past, you know, unfortunately, there was a lot of bad things. But there is one thing. I like to look at every bad thing and look at the good at it. And I tended to realize, you know, back like a year ago, I was still, you know, dating, getting to know more people. I feel people more opened up, meaning to say people wouldn't go on social media apps not knowing, like, house party, for example. And I feel like it put people in their homes and they're like, you know what? Let me come out a little bit of my comfort zone. And that got a lot of people to get to know a lot of people. And I know in the world that I'm from, you know, the Jewish world, proud of it. People got to know people and a lot of good things happened. You know, they met people that they would never get to talk to. And, you know, a lot of good things happened from there. So that was just a side note.
Well said, Izzy. I appreciate that very much. I will talk with you soon.
Yeah.
Hopefully
I'll
see you soon. Thank you, Izzy. Take care. Best to Deborah. And you, like, did you hear how horrible that phone connection was? That is an AT&T phone connection through and through. You can tell when someone calls
you and they sound like this, that they're on an AT&T phone.
You can tell. That's why it costs nothing. And again, if AT&T were to sponsor this radio program, then I would absolutely change my tune. But something that I will always think is trendy is Life Change Tea. Life Change Tea gives you a ton of energy without caffeine, which if you're like me and you have given up coffee for the time being, I don't say even given up. I'm taking a break from coffee. It's all the more important to find non-caffeinated sources of caffeine, and that's where Life Change Tea comes in. You can learn more about it by going to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. But it does more than give you energy. It detoxifies you. It gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. It removes your toxins. It also helps with your energy levels. It helps with energy. It is terrific. It really will help you eliminate all the toxins in your body. If you've ever had a difficult time with digestion, and if you ever somebody that has had a tough time being regular, Life Change Tea will help you. Go to the website, getthetea.com. And if you order some, actually, whatever you order on there, getthetea.com, if you use the promo code Frank, you will get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. That's getthetea.com, promo code Frank.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Put your sweet lips a little closer to the phone. Let's pretend that we're together all alone. I'll tell the man to turn the jukebox way down low. And you can tell your friend there have to go. Whisper to me, tell me, do you
Jibberies. He'll have to go. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. I want to thank Jim Mulligan and Chris Dunn for joining the Morano Radio Fans and Haters Facebook group. If anyone else joins that Facebook group within the next 10 minutes, I will mention your name on the air as well. Just go on Facebook and search Morano Radio Fans and Haters, and you can join. And that's the place where we have conversations about the show, topics covered on it, guests interviewed on it, callers that call into it, and so forth. Just search online, Facebook, Morano Radio Fans and Haters. We're talking about, I'm asking your predictions on things that are going to trend, maybe in the next year, maybe in the next 2 years. Pickleball, who would have seen that coming? Not me. So we're trying to make a list. I have coconut, curling, gin. I'm going to give you one more. I'm going to take a bunch of yours. This has been building for a few years, but I think it's going to go crazy. And we can have a discussion about the psychological reasons as to why. I think you are going to see an explosion in – I've used the word explosion a lot today. I don't know why. I mean, I'm sure Freud would have a field day with that. But I think you are going to see a significant increase in stuff for children that's geared for adults. Meaning, we've already seen the rise of adult coloring books. We've seen the rise of adult summer camp. I have a feeling that you are going to see any child product. I think you are going to see that marketed in a way for children. I mean, what is vaping really but an adult pacifier? I think, though, you will actually see real adult pacifiers. I think in a year, you will be walking down the streets of Manhattan and you will see 30, 40, 50-year-old people, not 50, but 30 and 40-year-old people sucking on a plastic pacifier, decorated with their favorite team emblem, decorated with the kind of stuff that they like, just as they did with meth. You will see an adult pacifier, and I don't think it ends there. Anything that's geared, I wouldn't be surprised if you see an adult playpen or an adult onesie. I think you are going to see the rise of all sorts of childhood products geared for adults. Watch. Watch and wait. 800-848-WABC. Ed the Milkman in New Jersey, what's going to be trending?
I think private schools, Frank. I think people are a little disgusted with the public school agenda, and they're going to look for a school that they feel comfortable sending their children to, something that has a curriculum that's more geared to their lifestyle or their way of thinking.
Haven't we already started to see that to some extent, though?
Yeah, you see it with some of these charter schools and all, but I think it's really going to grow.
Well, during the pandemic, when the public schools were doing remote learning, you couldn't get your kid into a Catholic school because they all booked to capacity so quickly. And I think now that these public schools are sticking with the mask mandates, I think that has only that trend has only continued.
Oh, it's going to be a big thing. I have a lot of customers that have young children or children that are becoming of school age, and that seems to be a priority to them.
And Ed, I think I've asked you about this before, but what your business being a milkman, is that something that was always pretty consistent, or did it make something of a comeback? And when?
It's something that, well, it was big years ago. I've been doing this all my life. It was a big thing. And then when they started with 24-hour convenience stores, that kind of, you know, hurt us a little bit. But what really hurt us was small families and people that go out to eat all the time. You know?
Well, but has it made a comeback now, the milkman business, milk delivery?
It made a big comeback with the pandemic, but I see that fading away now as people are going back to work and going back out to eat.
Interesting. All right. Well, yeah. If anybody needs a milkman, call Ed. He's our show's official milkman. Thank you, Ed. 800-848-9222. I want to thank Eric Trantham for joining the Marano Radio Fans and Haters Facebook group. I also want to thank Debbie Varas of Lawrenceville, New Jersey, for joining the Marano Radio Fans and Haters Facebook group. And, of course, the gentleman that is trying so hard to switch me to AT&T, Izzy Schwartz, for joining the Marano Radio Fans and Haters Facebook group, as well as Vincent Canali. Anybody that joins within the next 10 minutes, I'll mention your name as well. So just search Marano Radio Fans and Haters. Grayson is in Long Beach. Hello, Grayson.
No, Grace, not Grayson, just Grace.
Ah.
I just wanted to say that I think the trend, thank God, is for dresses to get a little bit longer. I've noticed on television that some of the young girls, or even the older ones, the dress hem hardly covers their behind, but now it's getting down closer to the knees and even a little below the knee and much more attractive. I think it's a trend that I see on different ladies on different shows, and the dresses are getting a little bit longer and a little nicer looking, I think.
Well, that's so interesting, Grace, because there is something, and I want to thank Molly for pointing this out to me because I didn't know about it. There is something called the hemline index, which is a theory that suggests that skirt length or hemlines rise or fall along with stock prices. It actually says that the most common version of this theory is that skirt lengths get shorter in good economic times, like the 20s and the 60s.
Well, Jesus, we must be booming because some of the girls.
And longer in bad times, like the 1929 Wall Street crash. However, the reverse has also been proposed. But you're saying that you think longer dresses is on the horizon.
They're getting further down toward the knee.
All right.
Absolutely. Can I just say one thing? I listen to this station all the time, and I was so accustomed for so many years to listen to the two talk show guys who preceded you. And I thought, how am I ever going to get used to this one man that I never heard of, I don't know? You are a delight. What a pleasant man you must be in person. If you come across so really a family man, so lovely, and to me, I forgot completely about the two guys who were there before, but you really are a great, great companion in the middle of the night, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Well, that is awfully nice, Grace. I don't know how to follow that. I wish I had something glib intelligent to say, but that is wonderful.
Glib. Not glib, just thank you, because you really are a pleasure. I'm a really old gal, and so I don't require much sleep. So I'm up at all hours, and I listen to you, and I think, what a nice guy. He must be, you know, really good. Good family man, expecting and everything so good with it.
Well, thank you, Grace. I must
thank you very much for many hours of, I was going to say sleepless nights, but they're sleepless, but enjoyable.
Wonderful.
When I listen to
Wonderful. That's awfully nice, Grace. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I want to know how much you're paying these people. This is the second call we've gotten tonight like that.
Really? No, I mean, that's, what can I say? I am these folks. I am your nighttime / early morning companion. Tell you something else I think is coming back. The yo-yo. Okay? Yo-yos, they're an extraordinary amount of fun. And I think they're making a comeback. I really do. So I got the yo-yo, coconut, gin, the speakeasy, fluffernutter, pet clothing, online grocery shopping, concierge healthcare. And I'm going to give you one political trend. And I've predicted this for 20 straight years. And so far, by and large, I have been wrong for 20 straight years. The longer I live, eventually I might be right about this. But I am predicting within the next year or two, maybe three, the rise of a third major political party. I think America's ready. And I don't know what it's going to be called. I don't know what it's going to look like. But I am predicting the rise of a third major political party. Not another third party, but a third major party. 800-848-9222. Big Julie is in Brooklyn. Hello, Big Julie.
Hey, Frankie. Listen, I can see, like, I'm in Williamsburg here, and I'm starting to see people looking behind them to see where they're going. The next prediction I'm seeing, which I hear it, people are listening, younger people are listening to Frank Sinatra music, I think maybe thanks to Joe Piscopo.
probably. He's done a lot for the chairman, that's for sure.
Yes, and I just, well, actually, there's another thing, too, I'm noticing, too, and you've probably seen it on television. They're listening to a lot of the old Motown hits, and even over here, they're playing the radios and everything, and I'm hearing the old music because people are looking behind them to see where they're going, because I think we're running out of good music, and the old stuff is bringing people back alive again, Frank.
Could be. So the oldies, oldies but goodies, 800-848-9222. Leo is in Manhattan. Hello, Leo.
Hi, Frank. How are you doing? I have a political trend. Not really too optimistic, but I've been through the evolution of these steps, and I can see it over here going step by step, so I get a prediction what's going to happen next. I believe that very soon, after all the streets going to be renamed, it's going to come time when the government, the Democratic government, is going to put on the list of books and names of authors which are just going to be forbidden. It's going to be taken off the bookshelf of the stores. And basically, if you remember Ray Bradbury, 475 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury. Yes, I've read it, actually.
Sorry, burning books. Something similar is going to happen over here.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Leo. I think we're already seeing a portion of that. If you look at Amazon's book censorship, we are absolutely seeing. We're seeing a digital book burning. Try and get
worse.
I think you might be right, unfortunately. Try and get one of these books that's banned by Amazon. Try and get it elsewhere. The publishing houses don't want to publish it. If Amazon doesn't want to carry it, and this goes to my issue with Jeff Bezos. If the publishing houses won't publish it and Amazon won't carry it, you can't sell it. The book is essentially banned. It's not literally banned, but it's virtually banned. 800-848-9222. Gordon in Canada, give me a trend.
A trend. Bankboard, shuffleboard, and pool halls. And I agree with your Malibu coconut rum. I love that stuff. Mm. And pickleball's big up here, too.
Oh, it's big all over the place. It's exploded.
You know what's also big up here?
Tell me.
I was last night when you were saying about the Chinese taking over the American farms. Is ginseng, where they used to grow tobacco here in Ontario, it's all ginseng farms now. And I was wondering, I'm going to try to find out who owns them.
Oh, that's interesting. I remember ginseng was very 1999. That's kind of was ginseng's heyday. I feel like it's sort of waned in popularity, but hey, who knows? We could see I'm predicting a comeback in gin. You could predict a comeback in ginseng. I want to commend Jeff Gaylor for joining the – that's not a formal commendation. It's more of a lowercase commendation – for joining the Facebook group. And I want to welcome aboard Scott McKay Hummel for joining the Facebook group, as well as Bruce Held, Vinny Pasculi, and Michael Lachesse. And if you join the Facebook group within the next 5 minutes, I will also thank you for joining. All right. Coming up next, we could soon, all of us, Juliet, Christian, Deb Valentine, Molly, me, have a date with Joe Nolan. We'll explore it next. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moran. I want to thank Stephen Knappholz for joining the Facebook group. You can just do so by going to Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's Morano Radio Fans and Haters. Richard Rogers. I don't think that's the playwright, but it might be. As well as firefighter Kevin Tracy and Raymond Corsetto Jr. And if you're listening to the show on podcast, you can certainly join the group. It's a great group to be a part of most of the time. But, you know, we have our moments. We have our moments. But you will not be thanked publicly. 800-848-9222. I want to thank Brian Mencius and Robert Milosh as well for joining. But if you have a thought on a trend that you see continuing, I was very interested in a story that I read on the WABC Early News yesterday, in which I teased it first. And it was a story about pizza. And you can tell by my less than impressive girth that I am a pizza lover. And the story basically was that they want to – they're coming out with a new book. And the new book claims that – the pizza capital of the country is Portland, Oregon. Portland, Oregon. So in teasing the story, you know, I kind of asked Joe Nolan, who we have traffic and transit on the sevens in that 5 o'clock hour. I asked him about whatever we're talking about, as long as it's not too controversial. You know, you don't want the traffic guy weighing in on the war in Afghanistan and stuff. You know, you don't want his traffic reports being controversial. But I asked him about his favorite pizza place. This is what he said. I'm sorry, Christian. I didn't give you enough of a heads up there.
Traffic and transit on the 7th. I'm going to tell you what – well, we'll do this date in history. And the top of next hour, I'll tell you where you can find the best pizza in any place in America. The answer may surprise you. 557. Joe Nolan, what is your favorite pizza destination if you had to pick?
Right here in Westfield, Ferraro's.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Great. Absolutely phenomenal. It's what I grew up on, you know. So, I mean, it's I love it. Absolutely phenomenal. Mm. Great place. I'd love to take you there one time.
Hey, I'm game. You don't have to ask me.
Great twice. Italian food. Really, really good stuff.
So now Joe construed my question, and I left it kind of vague, but Joe construed my question. I was asking it as, what's the pizza capital of the country? Like, what's the best pizza? Is it New Haven, Connecticut? Is it Chicago? Is it Brooklyn? Is it Staten Island? Is it Detroit? You know, there's different places that people say. Or is it Portland? And Joe volunteered a specific location in Westfield, New Jersey. So then after that, minutes after, he sends me an email, but he's one of these people that will email you from a cell phone. And so it doesn't come up as their email address. It comes up as their mobile phone number. That's kind of annoying. Once you start doing that, you know you're probably getting close to retirement age, quite frankly. I mean, you got to be able to differentiate text messaging and email, in my opinion. But he's a great guy. So then this is what he sends me right after, minutes after that. He says, "Hey, bud, no kidding. The food is really, really good for hours in Westfield. I'd love to have you and Juliet come out. Come on out with Christian and whomever else. Deb, have a big team dinner on me." And presumably that includes Molly, even though Joe doesn't have a lot of interaction with Molly yet. But I thought that was very nice. And then I asked him about it on air with Juliet, and he reiterated his invitation to us.
So quality ingredients, like, I mean, what are they talking about? We have quality ingredients here.
When,
it's just
apparently we don't. But apparently when the book is out, we're clearly going to have the author of Modernist Pizza on this radio program to discuss it.
Well, I'd also like to fly out to Portland personally to find out what exactly is going on here.
Let's get you to Westfield, New Jersey first so you can try the Joe Nolan place.
That's true. I have found that there's really some excellent pizza along the in the beach towns along the Jersey Shore. I have to tell you, some of the best pizza around Jersey Shore.
I don't think that's true,
Where
by the way.
Specifically would you recommend?
Well, I actually found some really good places in Rumson, New Jersey, in Red Bank, New Jersey.
I've never been
there. I think Rumson as well. But I don't remember the specific places. I remember it was on the boardwalk somewhere, maybe in Atlantic City or maybe south of Atlantic City.
Well, it's funny. I just posted on Facebook an article ranking the 10 best pizza shops along the Atlantic City boardwalk.
Oh,
so
okay.
If people are planning a trip down there, maybe for Mob Movie Con this week, they can check out and compare their own rankings to those in this list.
And then you also have a personal preference style. Like,
sure,
you like the thin crust, you like the thick crust.
Exactly.
I mean, one of my favorite pizza places in the world is in Chicago, and it's that pizza in a bowl place where it's just, it's outrageous. It's so good. But I mean, that's not the pizza that I would choose as the best pizza.
Right. Right. Again, everything is subjective. You're exactly right.
But they're wrong. They're wrong about Portland.
All right. 607. We are working on coordinating a WABC Early News pizza outing at Joe Nolan's favorite pizza shop in Westfield, New Jersey. And Joe, you are claiming you're going to pay for this meal.
Yes. Oh, it'll all be on me.
Well, of course.
Wow.
He's got a boat. He's got a second home.
Well, I will certainly be there.
So this sounds pretty good. I'm actually looking forward to this. Most things that I get invited to, I kind of don't want to go to. But this is one that I actually do want to go to. So we were talking, Christian, about when to do this. And we were saying maybe a Friday would work, even though Fridays, you know, Fridays are in short supply. I think the difficulty is going to be wrangling everyone's schedule. But we're looking at maybe next Friday.
Yeah, Fridays are always doable.
Are you down for this?
I've been down to go hang out with Joe Nolan for a while. He sounds like a very good time.
All right. Molly, what do you say? Are you going to participate in this?
Yes. Yes. Sorry, I was a little distracted. Yeah, I'd love to. I love Atlantic City. And Joe Nolan makes me laugh even more than you.
Well, I don't blame you. It's Westfield, New Jersey, though. No, not Atlantic City. Very different place.
I'm sorry.
They do have a great Japanese restaurant that I was at in Westfield one time. I had this, I don't know the name of it, but I had this grilled octopus there that was out of this world. Deb, are you down for this Westfield, New Jersey adventure? Yeah, she's nodding. Yeah, I think Deb's down. All right. Fred Levine commenting on the Facebook, in the Facebook group. I was never thanked when I joined this group. Well, you know what, Fred? I didn't get any Mets tickets when I got my vaccination. I didn't get any lottery tickets when I got my vaccination. I joined, you joined because it was the right thing to do. And I got my vaccination because it was the right thing to do. Now, unfortunately, you know, it's a limited time promotion. It's one day only. So there you have it. Well, and speaking of that one day only promotion, we also want to thank Laura Fahey Pate and Mike Delvecchio for joining the Facebook group. All right. We'll do 15 seconds of fame next. You can comment on any issue you like as long as you do it in 15 seconds or less. 800-848-9222 if you want to queue up. Gary, Fred, Terry, Neil, and Peter are already ready. A couple of open lines for you. 800-848-WABC. Straight ahead.
It's too wonderful. It's too beautiful. It's a fantastic thing.
the great Jimmy Rogers. It is time for you to be heard for 15 seconds, and only 15 seconds if you dial 1-800-848-9222, 1-800-848-WABC. Time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Let me begin with Peter in Greenwich Village.
New York always had thugs and gangsters, but one thing that tamed them down was love songs. Tell Castro Mastidi, bring doo-wops back. Everybody loved them. Italians, Jews, blacks, etc. Thank you.
That's not a bad suggestion. John's probably listening right now. I wouldn't be surprised if he listens. Neil on Staten Island, hello.
Hello. Happy birthday to my youngest son, Stuart, 37 years old. And one day you'll be saying the same thing to your son, little Neil.
Thank you. Terry in Bayside, hello.
Bongo Mike is a combination of Beavis and Butthead and Lieutenant Columbo. And folks, you don't know, Lieutenant Columbo loves Harpo Marx.
All right, Fred in Yonkers.
Frank, it's come to my attention that the Flory Dories have fallen out of favor. Would you join the He-Man, Womanators Club, something?
Gary on Staten Island.
One China matter, Wahia, one China matter, one China matter.
Anthony in Georgetown.
Yeah, just getting up, so I don't know if you've covered whether you've the personal attack on me by Senator Paul yesterday, or again you've wasted 4 hours of broadcast time.
Mark in Newark.
Juliet is always happy. How she does that, we want a recipe.
Joe in Manhattan.
While Eastern Europeans yearning for an American visa have been stranded in their own countries, selfish and patriotic Democrats are waging a war for illegals from hither and thither, and Republicans for emptying the Cuban prisons into this once great nation. Thank you.
Tom in White Plains.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing. The Chinese are out to take us. They are. They've been talking about they need more land. You know why they ruined the earth? They grow nothing that's worthwhile. Taste cornflakes sometimes. They don't taste the same. You know where they come from? China.
That is another proud AT&T customer, my friends. All right. Coming up next, Juliet Huddy and I are going to bring you the news. Rola and Tony and those of you that we didn't get to today, call back. We'll start with you tomorrow for 15 Seconds of Fame. We had a lot of great news coming your way. Sid Rosenberg's got sports. The pizza-loving, fully vaccinated Joe Nolan has traffic. And I've got some interesting things to say as well. To be continued.